Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
High school football in Texas is probably behind God and guns. Well, I don't know. Right behind God, probably.
In the state of Texas, there is no bigger community-involved activity than high school football.
As schools figure out their coronavirus plans for the fall semester, a big question is what happens with high school sports. States like California, Washington, and New Mexico have postponed many fall sports to the spring. But in Texas, where Friday nights in the fall are for football, public schools are going to give athletics a go. Michael Marks from member station KUT has more.
This is the big season for the Fulshear High School volleyball team. The Chargers won the school's first state championship last year, and they've got a lot of experienced players returning. But as coronavirus cases in Texas rose, then fell, then rose again, it became less and less clear whether they'd get a chance to defend their title.
You know, worried about my seniors not having their senior season, and to not have that would have just been devastating.
That's the team's head coach, Sydney Gocher. She breathed a sigh of relief last week, though, when the high school sports governing body known as the UIL announced its plan for the fall. Sports and activities like marching band got the go-ahead, with smaller schools starting on the normal date and bigger schools following a month later. Since bigger schools tend to be in areas with more coronavirus cases, the delay is supposed to help slow down the spread. Jamie Harrison is with the UIL.
Given all of the challenges, the variety of ways that COVID-19 is impacting different communities across Texas, this is the best solution we could develop based on what we know today.
Harrison said the UIL would only cancel fall sports as a last resort, but schools can choose to opt out. It's a decision athletic directors like Cheryl Fillmore are grappling with.
I guess the thing that I'm most concerned with is the fear that this disease, this terrible disease, could affect our community. And so with that, it's like, is it really safe to allow our kids to come back?
Fillmore is the AD at West Oso High School in Corpus Christi. The district schools will open on August 24th, and the first few weeks will mostly be online. But the school's volleyball and football teams can start practicing well before that.
Being that they're not face-to-face instruction, if they can't do that, is it really safe for them to come back to the athletic arena? We have a concern about that.
Schools are required to follow certain social distancing guidelines, but coaches realize that even if they play by the book, there's no guarantee that they'll get a whole season. There's at least an opportunity, though.
You know, I think if we're following the rules like we should, and we will as coaches, I think there's a reasonable chance we're going to be able to navigate our way through this.
That's Rodney Webb, president of the Texas High School Coaches Association and the head coach of the Denton-Geyer High School football team. As things currently stand, he doesn't see calling off or delaying the season.
You know, a lot of people say, oh, there's a football coach talking. He just wants to get his football fix in. Our kids need this diversion. Our schools need it. Our communities need it. It is woven into the fabric of our society. Those Friday nights are a microcosm of all that's good in our society.
The question that parents, principals, and superintendents across the country have to answer is whether the good that comes out of those Friday nights is worth the risk that comes with them. For NPR News, I'm Michael Marks in Austin, Texas.
After a long hiatus forced by COVID, the NBA resumes its season tonight and with the playoffs soon after. It comes just 1 week after Major League Baseball began its delayed season and just days before the National Hockey League is set to return. But as Anna Navaz tells us, there are very big questions brewing about the return of professional sports.
Judy, even as the pro leagues are starting back up, they're doing it in very different ways. The NBA has moved its league into a bubble of sorts in Orlando, limited to just players, coaches, and staff. And since mid-July, no players have tested positive. Major League Baseball, however, is allowing teams to travel for a shortened season, and it's now dealing with an outbreak. 19 players on the Miami Marlins that set off new protocols and delayed games. To unpack all of this, I'm joined by syndicated sports columnist Mike Wise. Mike Wise, welcome back to the NewsHour. Gotta say, after all the planning, all the safety precautions, all the protocols in the MLB, days into what's supposed to be an all-out sprint of a 60-game season, this is where we are. Are they going to make it to 60 games?
Well, as a sports journalist by trade, I hope so. I don't think it's going to happen. I just think the pandemic is something that's going to be not just with society, but with sports for a long time. And if I were the Major League Baseball commissioner, Rob Manfred, I would have thought seriously about pushing my season back to 2021. And for various reasons, I thought there was an almost, I don't want to call it warped, but a misguided arms race for the North American sports leagues, the major revenue ones, to get back on the field of play as soon as they could and be the first one to capture American eyeballs. I don't know why, because clearly, as the Miami Marlins have shown, it makes no sense. When you get a third of a major league roster testing positive for the coronavirus, you're endangering not just the health of the players, but your season.
Meanwhile, in the NBA, it's a very different story, right? The season restarts tonight. They announced recently, as I just mentioned, of the 344 players down there in that bubble, that enclosed space, none have tested positive since they got down there. So are there lessons, as you look at how the NBA has unpacked this, are there lessons there for other pro leagues?
Well, I think the lesson is you want to become the Truman Show. You want to put everything you can into a bubble, and you want to essentially hermetically seal yourself off from the world. I think what Adam Silver, the NBA commissioner, has done is pretty amazing, and it should be modeled and lionized across the country. I also think to work in that bubble, there has to be some sort of disassociation and almost, a cognitive dissonance from what's happening outside the bubble. I mean, we're talking 286 people died in Florida from the coronavirus yesterday. That's the third straight day of record fatalities in the hottest spot in the country. Some of those people who died are mere miles from where LeBron James and many of the players are staying in an opulent Disney-owned hotel and property. And so while on one hand I admire the NBA and I can't wait to see the games, there's a part of me that has to say, well, gosh, you really have to work hard not to see what's happening outside the bubble, because if you do, you might realize that basketball shouldn't matter as much as it does right now.
Meanwhile, with the WNBA, we should mention they've already restarted their season.
Yes.
And there's been a lot of interesting conversations in the league already. The entire league dedicated their season to the memory of Breonna Taylor, who was killed in her home by Louisville police earlier this year, and to the Say Her Name movement. Before the season opener, we should say both teams walked off the floor before the national anthem. You have players saying that they're not even coming back because they want to commit themselves to the Black Lives Matter movement right now. There is a connection between what's happening in the league, in the bubble, and what's happening in the rest of the world.
This is true, and this is where I will give the NBA, especially in the WNBA, some big credit. We're living in an unprecedented era of social conscience among athletes. It's almost a renaissance from the 1960s of Arthur Ashe and Tommy Smith and John Carlos putting the Black Power salute up in Mexico City. These athletes are using a platform to essentially better the world and speak out about society's wrongs and ills in ways that none of us can.
You know, Mike, so many people really miss sports and they're really wanting it to come back, but safely. Do you think that they will?
I'd like to think so. I think it's important that sports resembles the resilience that we have going on in society against this pandemic, against this racial reckoning we're dealing with. But I'm worried right now. And then I think the reason is that this doesn't feel like after 9/11, when the New York Yankees had sort of rallied a town and a country together in the wake of the terrorist attacks. It doesn't feel like post-Katrina and the New Orleans Saints, where you could feel a town lifting up an area and this communal hope and bonding happening. Right now, Major League Baseball resembles the worst of society. The pandemic's going on, and players are catching it. And God forbid if a manager, an elderly manager, gets the virus and ends up in the hospital. So I'd like to see it come back. I just don't know if it's going to anytime soon. And that's about as real as I can be about it.
We'll take the realness. We appreciate it. Mike Wise, syndicated columnist, joining us tonight. Thank you so much, Mike. Good to see you.
Thank you.
One of the ways that I see racism, white supremacy being taught just in the news, particularly, we want to use a specific example, one of the ones that we talked about, former presidential candidate Herman Cain, PhD lesson in racism, white supremacy. When we spoke last week, you said that Herman Cain, this is a representation, this individual is a representation of what white people want to see, the way that they enjoy seeing black people depicted. Could you kind of elaborate on that a bit?
Herman Cain reinforced for a whole lot of white people all the negative stereotypes we had been taught to believe about people of color, particularly black males. He was arrogant. He wouldn't have been called arrogant had he been white. We don't call Newt Gingrich arrogant. Well, some of us do. We call him lots of other things, too. But he was behaving in ways that we expect, we have accused blacks of behaving. He was interesting, but he was a loose cannon, we thought. Now, Newt Gingrich is a loose cannon, but it's all right for him to be a loose cannon because he's white. He was all the things. He was not faithful to his wife. That's part of that sexual myth of black males that we have in this country. He reinforced all those ugly stereotypes. He was chucking and jiving that's the way we describe, many of us describe black males, when he should have been very settled and serious about what he was doing. And white folks liked that. He was like watching what used to be a minstrel show.
Herman Cain, who launched a memorable but unsuccessful run for the GOP presidential nomination in 2012, has died. The former Godfather's Pizza CEO turned politician had been hospitalized since early this month with COVID-19. He was 74 years old. NPR's Don Gagne has this report.
From the beginning, Herman Cain was no typical politician.
Shucky ducky, as the man would say.
That's him announcing his presidential run in May of 2011.
I stand here today as the son of a chauffeur and a domestic worker.
It was a crowded GOP field that year, and for months, Cain was an also-ran. But the businessman hammered and hammered away at one simple idea, something he called his 999 plan.
This economy is on life support. That's why my 999 plan is a bold solution.
This is from a debate on Fox News.
9% business flat tax, the 9% personal income tax, and the 9% national sales tax.
Cain's GOP opponents attacked, saying it would mean higher taxes for many Americans. Then there was foreign policy, where Cain even joked about how little he knew. This was on the Christian Broadcasting Network.
And when they ask me who's the president of you, Becky, Stan, I'm going to say, you know, I don't know. Do you know? And then I'm going to say, how's that going to create one job?
But none of it seemed to hurt him in the polls, not even allegations of sexual harassment from his time as a CEO. Instead, his support grew until he led the field in Iowa by the fall. Back then, pollster Scott Rasmussen talked to NPR.
Well, it's almost as if they're saying, we know that Herman Cain has had some trouble talking about issues like Afghanistan and abortion. He's having trouble responding to these allegations. But then again, he couldn't possibly do any worse than the guys that have driven us so far in debt over the past few generations.
That could just as easily describe the way Donald Trump supporters talked about him 4 years later. Through it all, Herman Cain seemed to have as much fun running for president as anyone ever had. Until he didn't. His disorganized campaign and those harassment allegations caught up with him. This was on Fox News.
As long as I was still low in the polls relative to the Republican nomination, this stuff didn't come out.
He denied any wrongdoing, but still dropped out before the Iowa caucuses. Cain went back to a previous career, a talk radio show. In recent years, there was a podcast.
Shucky ducky. This is the Herman Cain Show.
Just last year, President Trump nominated Herman Cain to the Federal Reserve, but when some Republicans voiced concerns, he withdrew. He had been in the hospital for almost a month battling COVID-19. Cain was in attendance at that Trump arena rally in Tulsa in late June. He was photographed in the crowd, no face mask, not social distancing. It's not known if that's where he caught the virus. Today, his one-time opponent, Mitt Romney, tweeted out condolences, expressing sadness and adding, quote, St. Peter will soon hear 999. Don Gagne, NPR News.
Jails ain't tough enough. Jails ain't tough enough. We gotta have a death penalty. Jails ain't tough enough.
California is in peak fire season and does not have all the firefighters it needs. That's because the state relies on prison inmates to help contain its largest wildfires. From KQED, Kevin Stark reports the pandemic sidelined more than 1,000 inmates.
Last year's Wine Country Kincaid Fire in Sonoma County had Jason Dixon working furiously.
We had the saws going in the beginning, and everyone's using hand tools, scraping a six-foot cut all the way around the fire's edge.
Dixon and I first spoke last October, a day after he and other inmate firefighters made an aggressive stand to protect a neighborhood nestled in the Golden Foothills.
Absolutely seen flames. Enough to singe your beard hair.
This year, the pandemic has kept him off the job. In June, officials put more than half the state's inmate firefighting crews on lockdown after they were potentially exposed to the coronavirus through an outbreak at a training facility. As the summer heat bakes state forests, Dixon is stuck at his fire camp, one of more than 40 located in rural parts of the state.
We're trying hard to get out there on the fires. You know, we're working out daily still, training hard, but we're dealing with the coronavirus, so we're getting thrown speed bumps left and right.
People like Dixon carry heavy backpacks and perform vital but backbreaking grunt work. They use saws and axes to clear underbrush around a fire. California has used inmate firefighters since the 1940s. In recent years, more than a fifth of the state's wildfirefighters were inmates. But COVID-19 has put many in quarantine, while others have been sent home from prison. California's governor has granted early release to thousands to depopulate crowded prisons and to slow the spread of the coronavirus.
The folks that are, you know, on quarantine, we're hoping they're going to get off of that and be available again this fire season.
Christine McMorrow is a spokesperson for the state fire agency. She says California is scrambling to hire hundreds more seasonal firefighters as backfill.
There's always the possibility, right, that some crew somewhere is going to get quarantined.
Inmate firefighters are paid only a few dollars a day to do very dangerous work. Sometimes it costs them their lives. And every year, critics of the program point out that inmates face an uphill battle getting hired by a fire agency after their release because of their felony records. One of those critics is Charles Patillo. He used to oversee the program that helps employers hire incarcerated workers. Rather than using cheap prison labor for firefighting, he says the state should train more young people for these well-paid jobs.
We have tons of kids that are 18 to 25 out there that could be trained as firefighters, and we wouldn't have this big shortage that they're having.
Inmate firefighters on lockdown spend most of their day in their dorms. Jason Dixon, who fought the Kincaid fire last year, says he's at least happy to be quarantined at a fire camp and not a general population prison. He's staying in firefighting shape by doing push-ups. He knows it's a long shot, but he hopes to be hired to fight wildfires when he's released from prison next year.
The best thing is the reaction of the people's face, because you run into people on the fire who live out there, and they're like, they're very thankful. It's like, it makes you feel good inside.
For now, Dixon thinks mostly about avoiding the coronavirus and getting back to defending homes from wildfires once he's out of quarantine. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Stark in San Francisco.
A little matter of history. When I was a young man, a boy, really, I found barbershops to be fascinating places, where there, men gathered in an air of relaxed familiarity and discussed things they didn't do elsewhere. I heard tales of ancient African empires, of unknown roads of black history, and often the name of the brilliant self-taught historian, J.A. Rogers. I'd later search many a bookstore for his work, often without success. I thought of those days because of a little-known quote I'd read on the work of two late black scholars and historians, Ishaka Musa Barashango and Lerone Bennett. The quote was from Thomas Jefferson, president and slave owner, and it reflected his paradoxical nature. Said Jefferson of African slavery in America, 1 hour suffered under such conditions was fraught with more misery than ages of that suffered under the British by white Americans who rose in rebellion to oppose them. This is really a quite astounding statement by not only an American slave owner, but a revolutionary. It tells us all that Jefferson knew well the miseries inflicted by him and his class. One might even say he knew it intimately. If we take Jefferson seriously, he suggests something else, that blacks have a greater right to revolution than did British Americans under a foreign, distant king. Think on that. A little matter of history. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Well, explain to me why you want a white dentist all of a sudden.
Because I want the best available dentist for my tooth. That's why. Now, just by coincidence, the best dentist schools are of the white people, by the white people, and for the white people. Now, don't it seem likely that the best dentist would be white? White dentist, please.
Bibb County investigators looking for a person who vandalized signs near an African-American business in West Macon over the weekend. Avery Braxton spoke with investigators and the business owner, who had some strong words for whoever did it.
The signs lay just a few hundred yards away from an African-American-owned doctor's office. And while they say they don't know if they were targeted specifically, the hatred message will still not stand.
Mercer Junction is normally a quiet road, but on Monday morning, Dr. Frederick Burton and his staff came across a message that was rather loud.
I was just thinking that whoever did it were cowards.
A real estate sign was found tagged with hate speech, the N-word written multiple times, and a message that said, "All N-words go home." Just a few feet away, a stop sign was also found with the N-word sprawled across it. Burton wasn't impressed.
Well, I was just thinking that whoever did it were cowards, okay, and that there's so many other things and issues going on in this country that they had to concern themselves with that. So, and other than that, I just didn't want to give them the satisfaction of knowing that that was there or anything was going on.
Burton's practice, Northridge Family Health Care, and a temple are the only buildings on Mercer Junction. If you drive by Mercer Junction now, you'll see what was once a two-fold sign has been ripped in half. And you can still see the depression in the grass where the sign lay for most of Monday afternoon. The stop sign has since been painted over. Investigators aren't sure if this was targeted hate speech, which can now be a felony in Georgia, or just teens with a poor attempt at humor.
Vandalism's always been a serious crime, but if it's racially biased or gender biased or religiously discrimination, any of those things, the sentencing is now much more strict than it was before. So if a teenager thinks it's funny, it's not funny.
Burton agrees and says if he was targeted, he won't be intimidated.
I'm not going to take it personally or anything. I'm just going to slide off and go from there. I'm not the one with the problem. Whoever wrote it is the one with the problem.
And he says he's here to stay. In Macon, Avery Braxton, 13 WMAZ News.
Anybody with information on the case could call Macon Regional Crime Stoppers at 1-877-68-CRIME.
The first thing we're going to do to, I think, stop racism is stop focusing on racism.
Stop focusing on racism.
Since June, there have been dozens of protests, marches, and rallies held across the North Country in support of the Black Lives Matter movement and against systemic racism. Yet over this same period of time, a series of racist acts have drawn headlines and alienated members of the region's small black population. As Julia Ritchie reports, communities across the North Country are grappling with how to explain and address these incidents.
About 2 weeks after the killing of George Floyd in police custody and protest over police brutality began spreading across the country, New York State troopers released information about an investigation into a cross burning. The incident took place on a person's property in the tiny town of Lisbon in St. Lawrence County. A spokesperson said they did not believe it was a, quote, bias-related incident. Cross burnings have historically been used by white supremacists as a form of intimidation against black people and other minorities. No other details have been released, but the June 9th cross burning was only the first in a series of disturbing incidents that have taken place over the last few months. Local Black Lives Matter organizer Jennifer Backstrom thinks it's likely a reaction to some of this summer's activism.
Yeah, we bringing them out. They're coming out the woodworks. They pissed. So, hey, but they need to bold up, come out and have a conversation with us.
She spoke while standing outside the Potsdam post office earlier this week for one of her near daily rallies she's held since George Floyd's death.
We deserve to live. We deserve to live.
2 weeks ago in Plattsburgh, kids on a playground discovered the N-word scrawled across the back of a metal slide. This week in Messina, police are asking for help in finding the person or people responsible for leaving a noose outside the home of a black family. But are there more race-motivated crimes in the region, or are people, especially white people, becoming more aware of them?
I think it's both. It's more happening and more people are feeling comfortable reporting it because they know that something's happening, something's, you know, changing.
Clyde Rabideau, mayor of Saranac Lake, agrees.
Everybody's antenna is up right now. We're very aware of these things, and maybe because we're so aware, there are people out there that want to, you know, take advantage of it and do graffiti, too.
Rabideau has been dealing with the fallout after racist graffiti, including the phrase, "Go back to Africa," was discovered last month under a train trestle in Saranac Lake. The new black director of the Adirondack Diversity Initiative, Nikki Hilton Patterson, moved out of town over safety concerns and criticized the village's slow response. Since then, Governor Andrew Cuomo called on a hate crimes unit to help investigate, and Rabideau says village officials have launched a public awareness campaign and will require diversity training for all staff and board members.
But community-wide, we are listening more. We are more aware. We're reaching out more. So I think these are the good points that are happening in the last weeks and months, and hopefully this momentum will continue for the betterment, not just with Saranac Lake, but all of the Adirondacks.
It appears Republican and Democratic politicians are starting to react more vocally on the issue of racism. After the noose incident, a joint statement issued by Congresswoman Elise Stefanik and state and county lawmakers read, quote, "This hateful display has no place in the North Country." But harmful displays are par for the course for people of color in the North Country, who say they feel unsafe in an area where Confederate flags are commonly seen flying on properties dotting the countryside. If anything, these incidents serve as a reminder of other types of structural racism encountered by black residents in their day-to-day lives. Clifton Harcum is a diversity officer at SUNY Potsdam. He moderated a webinar Thursday night called Driving While Black, hosted by the Adirondack Diversity Initiative. Harcum recounted his first time being pulled over after moving here. Asked why he was being stopped, the officer claimed the tag to his BMW was coming up stolen.
I was dressed like this. I was professionally dressed. You know, I didn't fit the profile, but I felt that feel, I might get shot. And I've never felt that way in a police interaction before.
Since then, Harcum says he's been pulled over a lot while driving around the Adirondacks.
These are things that take place where, at a point where people don't really understand or believe your stories, that you just figure why even stay in an area where people aren't trying to hear your voice.
He said it's sometimes difficult for white people to understand just how common these interactions really are. He said it's sad, but it's a reality that in America, black people have learned to navigate racism in their daily lives in order to keep moving forward. Julia Ritchie, North Country.
How does
humanity develop? How does it improve? How does racism, if it can, recede despite the overwhelming power of history?
Well, I think that the what's difficult to understand is how it's kept going, how it has stayed so firm for centuries. I mean, we've seen improvements in the way people think about gay Americans, for example. And I think that had to do with understanding that this could happen in your own family. You can actually have a gay son or a gay daughter, and these people were people, as you understand people to be. But because white Americans can keep themselves separate from black Americans, there is a sense that this other will never be who I am. So if there is a way to get people to understand, I don't know. I can't answer that question. I don't know. You know, Robin Kelly says that we're going to need a surrealist moment. There's going to have to be something that breaks the continuum. Because until white women start giving birth to black babies, I think we are going to stay living in these incommensurable experiences.
Finally tonight, our Now Read This book club conversation. Our July pick is a book that remains as relevant and powerful as when it was first written. Jeffrey Brown talks with author and poet Claudia Rankine about Citizen, an American Lyric, for our ongoing arts and culture series, Canvas.
In 2014, American cities were convulsed in the aftermath of the deaths of Michael Brown and Eric Garner, two of the killings that helped catalyze the Black Lives Matter movement. That year, the book Citizen, an American Lyric was published, with prose poems, monologues, and imagery capturing the moment, but through a different lens, the inner lives and thoughts of individuals, the almost casual racism that permeates daily life for so many. Author Claudia Rankine.
Racism is institutional, we know, but institutions are made up of people. So what are those thousand cuts that lead to the big institutional fails around racism? I asked people who I knew, friends, other colleagues, to just tell me moments where they were going along in their day and suddenly somebody said or did something that reduce them to their race. And so I collected these stories, rewrote them, got to the heart of what I was trying to portray.
You know, one of them that stuck with me, it's from a story called Stop and Frisk. A man is narrating his own experience as he's being pulled over by the police and keeps repeating this line to himself: "You are not the guy, and still you fit the description, because there is only one guy who was always the guy fitting the description."
And that line actually came from the person I was interviewing. He said, and of course I wasn't the guy, but I was the guy who fit the description again. And so that became a refrain as I sort of crafted that poem.
You know, several of our readers asked about the form of the book, because you have prose poems, monologues, you have photographs and images. What was your thinking about how to structure the book?
Well, I've always felt that visual artists have been able to portray these kinds of ways in which racism hits the body in ways that were so succinct. You just saw it, you understood it, and so I embarked on this collaboration with the works of these visual artists without even them knowing, because I was just requesting the use of an image in the book. But I really wanted people to engage all of their senses in the book, from their sight to their reading skills to their body, so that these moments really sat inside them.
The book came out in 2014. It was incredibly timely at that moment. How do you look at what's going on now in light of what you wrote then?
Well, you know, Henry Louis Gates, a long time ago, wrote a book called The Signifying Monkey, and he said that African-American writers were always in conversation with the time and with each other. And I feel like Citizen was just the next book that looked at the same dynamic that Toni Morrison was looking at, or Frederick Douglass was looking at, or James Baldwin, obviously. And so if I had published Citizen in 2007 or 2012 or 2015 or yesterday, it would have the same mirroring relay effect, because those events have been going on and continue to go on.
A number of our readers, of course, wondered if you see signs of hope now.
The protests are incredible. We saw in Portland mothers of all races putting themselves in front of the military and protecting justice in this country, in a sense. And so that is new, the intergenerational cross-race gatherings that we have seen during the quarantine is unprecedented in this country.
When all of this is going on, when people are in the streets demonstrating and so much happening in the country, what does poetry or literature do? What does it offer?
I think writers, as culture makers, are in that special place where they are able to say what is, and that's it. They're not asking for something to happen or needing to create a transaction. They're just saying what is. In a sense, their work becomes a kind of record, but not the record of value. It's the record of experience.
All right. Citizen and American Lyric, Claudia Rankin, nice to talk to you. Thank you for being part of the book club.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Great conversation. And Claudia Rankin's new book, Just Us, An American Conversation, will be published in September. And for our August selection, something very different, Beijing Payback, a geopolitic thriller and crime novel. Author Daniel Nia will join us here at the end of the month. And we hope you'll join us and other readers on our website and Facebook page for Now Read This. It's our book club partnership with the New York Times.
White supremacy is the sickness.
Big city mayors are on the front lines of fights happening all over the country right now, and that includes our next guest, Atlanta's Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms. She is urging the federal government to stop sending federal agents to U.S. cities, fighting a lawsuit from Georgia's governor over Atlanta's mask requirement. The mayor is also trying to put the brakes on a plan to send kids back to school in person in the fall. All this while she is believed to be under consideration as a possible vice presidential running mate for Democrat Joe Biden. Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, welcome back to All Things Considered.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the issue of masks. Governor Brian Kemp, a Republican, is challenging Atlanta's mask requirement, and an emergency court hearing that was scheduled for today was canceled when the governor said he wants to continue good faith negotiations with you. Do you think you'll be able to negotiate a solution to this standoff?
We'll see. The most important thing is that we continue to keep at the forefront of every decision that we make the health and safety of the people who call Atlanta home. And what we know from our health professionals is that wearing masks goes a very, very long way in helping to stop the spread of COVID-19. And so I've always been abundantly clear that the business recommendations, advisory committee recommendations, were just that, recommendations for businesses to follow. But I do believe that a mask mandate is important, and it certainly is needed in the city of Atlanta as we are experiencing record-breaking numbers as it relates to COVID-19.
Governor Kemp's position is that mayors cannot implement public health policies that go beyond his executive orders. Why do you believe a mayor should be able to override a governor on an issue like this?
The governor belongs to a party that often speaks about local control and often elevates the need and desire for local municipalities to be able to make their own decisions as it relates to any number of matters, including when we entered the COVID-19 crisis, as schools were making decisions on whether or not they would close, the governor deferred to local control on those decisions. It is my belief that a mask mandate is also something that local control should rule on. The reason being, we know that our numbers are very, very high in Atlanta. They are high throughout the metro area. They are very high in cities with large populations throughout this state. And the only way that we, again, are going to get to the other side of COVID-19 is to start making smart decisions about how we proceed with the health and safety of our residents. And part of that, it's very simple, wearing a mask.
Let me also ask you about plans for the new school year. I know that one of your four children tested positive for COVID-19 and that you and your husband did as well, and I'm glad you're all okay. How does that experience as the parent of a school-aged child who had the disease affect your thinking about whether Atlanta students can safely go back to school in person?
My concern really is one that's born out of our experience because, again, we had one of our children to test positive, asymptomatic, and then my husband and I became infected a week later. This is what our teachers, our custodians, our cafeteria workers, our bus drivers, and so many others will face when our children go back to school, not to mention many of our children in Atlanta have higher than the national average rates of asthma. Asthma is very common with African-American children. African-American children are more likely to die from asthma than other races. And so there are a number of concerns, including our children then perhaps being asymptomatic and then going home and infecting and impacting their families. And we know in Black and brown communities, COVID-19 is more likely to be deadly.
We also know that in Black and brown communities, access to remote schooling resources are less available. And so how do you balance the need to educate the children, the need for parents to be able to do their work, with your expressed desire to keep people safe?
It's tough. And it's the reason towards the end of the school year that we began working with Verizon, with AT&T, with Sprint, and many of our other local carriers to try and get technology, iPads, and also hotspots into the hands of our kids. We did a pretty good job with that. There are still many children who still did not pick up their devices and hotspots at the end of the year, and we're working with the Atlanta Public Schools to try and make sure that everyone has access since their school year has been delayed by 9 weeks. As mayor, I don't control the schools per our city charter. It's an independently elected school board. But that being said, we're working very closely with our new superintendent to make sure that our children have what they need so that they can be prepared for school this fall.
Finally, I need to ask what you can tell us about any conversations you might have had with the Biden campaign as they search for a running mate.
Well, I've endorsed Joe Biden over a year ago, so my conversations with the Biden campaign can range from daily to weekly. So that hasn't changed. You know, far be it from me to second guess what he thinks he needs in a running mate. But generally speaking, we know that turnout is going to be extremely important this year. And I've heard the vice president say nobody votes for a president based on who's on the ticket. But I know this year it's going to be exceedingly important to have people excited about voting this year and giving people reason to literally risk their lives to go and vote. And I think, you know, Vice President Biden, of course, brings a lot of enthusiasm to the ticket. And I think anyone who he asks on that ticket should equally match that.
I'm really struck by that phrase, literally risk their lives to go and vote. That's where we're at, huh?
Absolutely. 2020 and COVID-19, that's where we are.
Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, thank you for talking with us again.
Thank you for having me.
Is that a real gun?
Yeah, this is a real gun.
Do you kill people?
No, if some guy's hurting someone, I try to shoot him in the leg or something, just to stop him.
Mama says police misshoot black people.
Is it true?
Yeah, is it true?
Is that true?
Yeah, is that true?
Is it true?
Rubber bullets, beanbags, these are some of the everyday terms used to describe munitions that can, in fact, be very dangerous, items that have been used to disperse recent protests across the country. An investigation by USA Today and Kaiser Health News shows that so-called less lethal munitions have been seriously injuring people for decades, even killing them. Jay Hancock worked on that investigation, and we started by talking about what kinds of projectiles police have been firing into crowds at recent demonstrations.
You read about the term rubber bullets a lot, which is kind of a casual catch-all term to describe these things, which really isn't super accurate. Some of them, they're essentially paintballs with chemical irritants, pepper chemicals inside them, and they burst upon impact. Some of them are called beanbag rounds, which are shot out of a 12-gauge shotgun, and instead of birdshot coming out of the shotgun, it's all encased in a bag, which comes out and hits you with a big thwack and can really injure as well. Even these things called sponge rounds or foam rounds, they sound like they're almost toys, but they can really seriously injure people.
And what are these projectiles normally designed for? Like, are police using them correctly?
It's unclear what they ought to be used for because there's no guidelines. That's one of the things we found. But there's a general understanding among law enforcement is that these projectiles should not be used for crowd management, i.e. riot control. They're generally sold as ways to deal with uncooperative individual people who are breaking the law as a way to bring people under control that is less than lethal and does not involve lead deadly bullets.
When did police start using these kinds of tools to disperse crowds? Do we know?
They've been around for decades, and they sort of picked up popularity in the early 2000s. The scale with which we've seen these projectiles used, the law enforcement experts that we talked to called the use now this year in 2020 unprecedented.
Does anyone have a theory for why using these tools, the popularity of using these tools has spiked so intensely?
I would say it's two things. One, there's been so much justifiable focus on the deadly use of force by police that anything less than deadly use of force sort of doesn't get paid attention to. The other reason is just what people describe to us as a severe lack of training among police forces and law enforcement in general in crowd management techniques. It's not something that the average officer has to deal with every day. And when they do have to confront situations with large numbers of people, which it must be said, sometimes pose a danger to police. There have been incidents where people throw bricks at cops and pose a danger to cops. This is the tool they have at hand, and this is the tool that they have in a situation where they haven't been trained well to handle hundreds of potentially hostile people.
I mean, are you getting the sense that now there does seem to be a different push to use these tools differently?
I think there is a recognition among law enforcement that if these sorts of street confrontations are going to continue, that they need to become better at this. We interviewed lots of experts, including folks at the International Association of Chiefs of Police, who weighed in on a previous deliberative process on the use of lethal force. They're now talking about taking the same scrutiny towards the use of less lethal force like this, because everybody that we spoke to, including people who are in the law enforcement community and who are, you know, basically pro blue line, they have concern for officers on the street. Even they recognize that the situation now with respect to this kind of, these kinds of projectiles is inadequate and needs to be changed.
Jay Hancock is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thank you very much for joining us today.
You are welcome, Elsa.
I watched a white riot in Portland, Oregon on television the other night.
Today, federal officers begin to withdraw from downtown Portland under a deal between Oregon Governor Kate Brown and the Trump administration. Things have been tense since federal agents arrived 3 weeks ago to crack down on racial justice protests. City leaders hope this will diffuse tensions. Portland's central role in this racial justice movement may surprise some people because Portland is one of the whitest big cities in the U.S. Oregon was founded on white supremacist principles, and the state has a long history of entrenched racism. For some context, Portland State University Urban Studies Professor Lisa Bates joins us now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you, Ari.
So white supremacy was literally written into Oregon's state constitution in the 1850s. What did that look like in practice?
Well, when the settlers came to Oregon, obviously they were, in the first place, engaged in a very brutal war against indigenous people here, and also did bring enslaved black people to help clear land and create farms. But the idea was that once you had established yourself, that you would remove those people.
Black people were literally not allowed in the state.
Right. No black person or Asian person, of course, that wasn't the term that they used at the time, could live in the state.
And moving forward in time, while many people think of the KKK as a Southern phenomenon, it had a huge presence in Oregon in the early 20th century. Tell us about that.
In the Portland area, many of the elected leaders, sheriffs, etc., were active members of the KKK, and that history of white nationalist organizing has persisted. In the 80s and 90s, Oregon was seen as a white homeland for people who believed in the idea of a racial holy war, and there are settlements throughout the state of people who are pursuing that kind of white homeland idea.
So how has that deep legacy of racism played out in, say, the last 50 years or the last few decades?
So after that history, we might wonder, how did black people really end up living in Portland? Mm-hmm. Black folks are about 6% of Portland's population, and many of these are families who were brought to work in the Kaiser shipyards during World War II, and after World War II remained in the city, despite just ongoing civil rights battles, and particularly around police. I mean, I guess I would point to a couple of significant incidents in the 1980s where Portland police officers dumped dead possums on the door of a black-owned business in the mid-1980s after killing a black man, Tony Stevenson, with a chokehold. The chokehold was banned, and the police union distributed T-shirts to officers that said, "Smoke 'em, don't choke 'em," with the image of a gun.
Do you see these protests today as a direct outgrowth of or reaction to the long history of racism and white supremacy that has been the building blocks of Oregon history?
For some people, yes. I think that we've had a number of protests over 15 years here about the problem of white supremacy in institutions. And of course, that's at the center of what's happening today. Over the past 2 months, I've seen marches for black trans lives. We've had movement around black victims of intimate partner violence. There are actions happening here almost every day, not all of which are focused around the Justice Center and the federal courthouse, because there's movement building that's happening from youth to elders among black indigenous and other people of color here, as well as allies and accomplices.
Lisa Bates teaches urban studies and planning at Portland State University. Thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you.
In Oregon, a standoff between the Trump administration and local officials could be nearing an end. Governor Kate Brown announced today that the federal government will pull back law enforcement who have clashed violently with demonstrators there since early July. We'll hear from Governor Brown in another part of the program. The Department of Homeland Security, meanwhile, is presenting the deal a little differently. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Dirk Vanderhart joins me now from Portland. Welcome.
Hey, thanks.
So this agreement could help bring down tensions that have been mounting for weeks in your city. How is the governor even framing the deal at this moment?
Yeah, she is really presenting this as a big win at this point. So for weeks, Governor Brown and other state officials have repeatedly demanded that the Trump administration pull back federal officers that, as you said, were sent here in early July. And under the deal announced today, Brown says at least some of those officers will begin to be phased out starting tomorrow. In their place, she is sending Oregon State troopers who will act as security for this courthouse, which has really been a focal point of the protests.
Mm-hmm.
In her statement today, Brown said the federal government, essentially said the government has conceded to her demands.
Okay, well, Acting Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf has also been talking about this deal. Would you say that he agrees with Brown's characterization of it?
Pretty clearly not. Wolf and other federal officials today have presented this as a win for their side. So their side is that they've been calling for local officials to protect the federal courthouse from vandalism or small fires that some demonstrators have sent. And they suggest that, you know, those demands have now been met because state troopers will be coming in to give that protection. But Wolf is also really downplaying this notion that federal officers are actually leaving the city, like Brown says. Here's what he said in a press conference today.
Our entire law enforcement presence that is currently in Portland yesterday and in the previous week will remain in Portland until we are assured that the courthouse and other federal facilities will no longer be attacked nightly and set afire.
You know, there is obviously a little discord there in these two versions, and we are still looking for more details into what's behind them. I think what's likely and possible is that DHS officers will remain nearby, maybe in the area, but will not actively be at the courthouse every night like they are now. We should note, though, that federal authorities who are normally assigned to protect the courthouse will still be present.
Okay, so if the presence of federal officers does diminish, how likely is that going to calm down the protesters, you think?
Well, I think state officials are certainly hoping it's very likely. These federal officers have drawn so much outrage in recent weeks. People have been very, very focused on getting them out of the city. And so, you know, the sense is this should help calm things. I don't know that we can assume it's going to solve everything here. I mean, the question will be how state troopers actually respond to demonstrators if things flare up again.
Well, I mean, the country has been pretty focused on Portland recently, mainly because the president sent these federal law enforcement officials there in early July. But protests have been going on for a lot longer than that, for you know, where you are. Can you just bring us up to speed on how things in Portland even got to this point?
Well, that's right. Yeah, actually, we are about 2 months into nightly protests for racial justice related to the killing of George Floyd. I mean, those have come in waves. So in late May, shortly after Floyd was killed, thousands of people were in the streets every night. That began to wane by late June when maybe around 100 of people a night were coming out and clashing with police. But as I said, the federal presence here has really, really energized things. You know, dads and moms and vets are coming out. Today's deal is going to change things. I think we can say that. We are just not exactly sure how.
That's Oregon Public Broadcasting's Dirk Vanderhart in Portland. Thank you.
My pleasure.
More federal officers are on their way to Portland, in addition to the 114 federal agents already there. That's according to Oregon Public Broadcasting. The agents say they are in Portland to protect federal property. And this influx of new federal officers happens as clashes between police and protesters are growing increasingly heated and even violent. As NPR's Kirk Sigler reports, that is a familiar dynamic in the Pacific Northwest.
A large crowd of Portland progressives chanting, "Feds, go home." But over the weekend, some heads turned when a few young men wearing flak jackets over their Hawaiian shirts showed up, so-called Boogaloo Boys, a mishmash of extremists calling for another civil war.
We don't support violence. I want to make that clear. We don't support violence. We're not racist.
The men refused to give their names in this video posted to Twitter by freelance journalist Sergio Olmos.
So, I mean, we're out here for a lot of the same reason that these people are out here for.
Extremists implying they're showing up to protest federal overreach in a liberal city seems like strange bedfellows. But in the Northwest, the far right has been protesting what it calls federal tyranny for years. And 4 years ago, Oregon was also in the spotlight for a protest that included vandalism of federal property.
For the Constitution.
The 41-day armed occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge.
Come on, baby.
There she comes.
Men in cowboy hats calling themselves patriots tore down fences and bulldozed over land considered sacred to Native Americans, causing close to $1 million in damage. In Portland this summer, the damage tally is much smaller, according to the government, an estimated $50,000 in vandalism so far. And here, the far right has mostly been quiet about the alleged federal crackdown. That's just fine with Eric Ward. He's executive director of Western States Center, a Portland group that tracks extremism in the Northwest.
We have our hands full
with a quasi-federal police force. We don't now need quasi-military formations on the streets of Portland to add to that.
For the past 3 years, far-right extremists have regularly descended on Portland to clash with leftists. These protests were often a spectacle, almost always tense, and sometimes violent. So few people here are eager to see any strange bedfellows alliances with far-right patriots, who Ward says are selfish.
With a few exceptions, they are made up of leaders who hold up the Constitution with one hand and crush it with the other.
One far-right leader who's lately shown support of the BLM cause, anyway, is Ammon Bundy. At the very Portland courthouse that's now the flashpoint of the new protests, Bundy was acquitted for leading that 2016 wildlife refuge occupation.
If you think that somehow the Black Lives Matter is more dangerous than the police, you must have a problem in your mind.
Bundy took to Facebook telling his followers that federal police forces have turned into a huge bureaucracy and need to be defunded.
If you think that Antifa is the one going to take your freedom, you must have a problem in your mind.
Bundy later claimed he was ostracized by his own supporters for saying that. Experts say that's because the far right generally views what's happening in Portland to be a liberal, urban political fight. But Western historian Patty Limerick says that could change. She says President Trump picked the wrong region for a standoff. There's a long and complicated history of fighting the federal government here, and it crosses political boundaries.
By one point of view, President Trump might have had an advisor, and he didn't, but who said, you know, this thing where you're going to be sending these personnel for federal agencies into a Western city? I wouldn't do that.
The city will be going into its 61st continuous night of protests tonight with no signs of the movement dying down. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Portland.
It was so hot. It was like 95, 100 degrees in the shade. The wind never blew.
And they say that New Orleans has humidity down there, which kind of cools us off. That's bullshit. It was death heat.
Inside the convention center, it was so stifling hot, people tried to stay outside.
Hot as hell, 100-something degrees.
It's hot.
It was very, very hot at that time. It was 97, 98 degrees.
It was hot.
The heat radiating off of the highway at night was intensely hot.
It's hot as hell.
That was the worst summer. I mean, that heat was ridiculous.
Man, hot as heck in here.
It was beyond Africa heat. If Africa heat was anything like that, like I said before, and I'll say it again, they keep saying go back to Africa. Hell no.
And we're still in this heat wave that began over the weekend. Predicted high for today in Central Park, 96. Not only is the heat uncomfortable, though, it's also the deadliest form of weather, killing more Americans annually than any other weather event. Each year in New York City, about 100 deaths and over 400 trips to the hospital for heat-related illness. Cities are 2 to 8 degrees hotter than their surrounding areas, typically due to what's known as the urban heat island effect. You know that? That's from tall buildings, dark roofs, and blacktop pavement that absorb sunlight. And this increased heat disproportionately impacts communities of color, including so-called fence-line communities with less green space and a closer proximity to industrial plants. In some of the most vulnerable neighborhoods, up to a third of the residents live below the city's threshold for poverty, making them less likely to afford air conditioners and the expensive utility bills that come with them. The result? New Yorkers of color are more likely to die or be hospitalized in hot weather events like this one. And like so many other racial justice issues, the coronavirus pandemic only furthers this disparity, leaving those vulnerable without access to life-saving cooling efforts that they might otherwise have. Joining me now to discuss the need for environmental justice reform in the city and as it pertains to heat is Sonal Jessel, Policy and Advocacy Coordinator focusing on extreme heat issues in New York for the group We Act for Environmental Justice. Sonal, thanks for coming on today. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan.
And listeners, we want to hear from you on this. Are you riding out this heat wave without air conditioning? How has the pandemic affected your ability to get cool? Would you normally go to a city cooling center, a library, the movies, or wherever else to get some relief from the heat? Now, I should say cooling centers with social distancing policies are open. There is a long list of city cooling centers that are open. We'll get to that. So now, what parts of the city are most impacted by heat-related death and illness? How specific can you get?
I can get pretty specific. I mean, we have generally it's the spaces that most communities of color live, and that comes from historic racist policies that have not invested in certain neighborhoods of New York City. So some neighborhoods that we see have really high heat vulnerability are places like East Harlem, Central Harlem, the South Bronx, some parts of Brooklyn, and East Inwood is an often overlooked part of the city that has high heat vulnerability. So there's a lot of spaces, but they really fall along the same lines of social inequalities and even COVID cases. You see the same communities are hit hardest by all of the different hardships that are coming up right now.
You want to talk about that in more detail? Because I think that's sort of the heart of it. What to you are the most important underlying environmental racism? And by environmental racism, we don't mean people who, you know, hate people of color doing things to them on purpose. I think we need to say this over and over again, that when we talk about systemic racism, a lot of it is it's baked into the system. It's not somebody who's got a KKK mentality trying to hurt people consciously necessarily. And yet, environmental racism, like other kinds of systemic racism, is real and really hurts people. So what would you say about the underlying conditions in that regard that people should know about?
Yeah, so you're right. I mean, environmental justice is the idea that there is disproportionate impact of environmental hazards on different communities, particularly communities of color, and that comes from historic policies and programs that have been put in place that has disadvantaged certain communities. So generally speaking, you see a lot of communities of color that have higher industrial sites placed in their neighborhoods that leads to high levels of air pollution, and then you see a much higher level of asthma and other respiratory illnesses in people of color in spaces like Harlem historically. And that's all coming from these policies that were put in place decades ago. So one of the biggest ones that we talk about and think about is redlining, which, you know, was around in the 1930s that basically categorized certain neighborhoods as too risky for investment and were denied public investment and services. And so what you have now is a lot of communities that are still struggling from that disinvestment or non-investment decades ago. And those are the same communities that are seeing really high levels of extreme heat, actually, because they're the spaces that didn't have investment in parks and trees and public services and, upgrading buildings, things like that. So now you have people of color that is in these neighborhoods that they've been in for a very long time that are dealing with a lack of adequate services and resources to withstand issues such as extreme heat. Extreme heat is just one of the many things that people are dealing with in these neighborhoods. I mean, another thing that people talk a lot about that's very related is building investment. In New York City, we have a ton of old buildings that in wealthier spaces are getting a lot of good energy efficiency upgrades. So people are, you know, getting central air, getting better ventilation in their homes, being prepared for extreme weather events, whereas the older buildings and lower income and communities of color aren't getting that same level of investment. And, you know, people in those spaces are struggling with so many hardships that it's hard to also advocate for yourself and take the time that you need to really understand the system to figure out how to gain access to these resources even to begin with. Yeah. So we see this as a result of decades long of disinvestment.
And how are those underlying systemic conditions that you describe and this heat wave and the pandemic interacting today?
Yeah, so I really say that heat is just making everything so much worse. The communities that are hit hardest by COVID-19 and cases and mortality are almost exactly the same communities that have really high heat vulnerability in New York City. And that comes down to the same issues. So there's people that don't have as much access to healthcare, for example, in low-income communities of color. And that also translates into higher heat illness, higher heat death. because maybe you don't access healthcare in the same way, or you have underlying chronic conditions like asthma that exacerbates both COVID-19 and heat illness, and that a lot of that comes from environmental racist policies that have placed industrial sites in neighborhoods and increased the rate of respiratory illness in these neighborhoods. So the same reasons why people are suffering more from COVID-19 tend to be, you know, the same for why people are dealing with extreme heat as a bigger issue in the neighborhood.
And I mentioned the cooling centers before, and I think it's important for people in the city, at least, and I don't know about the surrounding counties in this respect, but at least in the city, they are still providing cooling centers, even though you think, you know, most of the indoor spaces where these things would normally take place, libraries, things like that, are closed for normal indoor use. The city has opened cooling centers. So listeners, if you didn't know that and you need a cooling center to go to, you can call 311 and just give them your address and they'll tell you the closest one. But Sonal, you write, it isn't enough to offer spaces to cool down that happen to be in hardest hit neighborhoods. We must partner with communities to find safe and healthy spaces for gathering that are culturally significant and will therefore be more utilized. What do you have in mind?
Yeah, you know, we see with the cooling centers, our members of We Act for Environmental Justice, we're a membership-based organization, and our members went out last summer and surveyed a lot of the cooling centers in Northern Manhattan and found that there was, you know, while there's a lot of people in these spaces, like public libraries, senior centers, they were there because they were already going, not necessarily because they were seeking the cooling center program itself. So we're thinking about how do we increase utilization for these spaces, because they are an amazing and equitable space for people to go to cool down. You know, they're free, they're open, you can just walk right in, theoretically, and, you know, they're really important. It's a really important program to have. So how do we increase utilization? Because there's a lot of cooling centers that people just didn't go to last summer and the previous summers. So something that we're thinking about is, well, how do we kind of bring cooling centers to you instead of establish them in places that communities might not be going to anyway? So that one thing that our members are thinking about is doing kind of community asset mapping, where you have community members that are really have a lot of knowledge about the communities that they live in, their neighborhoods, and know the spaces that people like to go to hang out, to gather, to spend time together, and find a way to give funding for those spaces to become the cooling centers. So it's kind of like, how do we bring the program to you and make it seem like something that you would go to anyway, instead of having you sit in a library when you maybe otherwise wouldn't be going to libraries, and that's really not a space where you want to spend your Saturday. So we really want to find a way to open up the program to more people so more people use it.
So we've outlined some of the issues. What are some of the solutions?
Yeah, one of the biggest solutions that we're fighting for is considering energy efficiency and needing to upgrade people's homes. And especially this summer with COVID-19, people are spending a lot more time in their homes than they otherwise would. And then, like you mentioned, people go to the movie, people go to the shopping malls, people go to other spaces to get cool on a hot summer day in New York City that is really not accessible this summer. So one thing that we really are pushing, not only for this summer, but for the future, knowing that heat waves are just getting worse and worse and worse because of climate change, is how do we equip low-income communities and low-income households to have the adequate access to cooling that they need? So our biggest push right now is working, advocating with a lot of different organizations and a lot of different community members to ask for funding to retrofit buildings to bring up energy efficiency in low-income households so that people aren't just relying on these single AC units that rack up bills, suck up a lot of fossil fuels, but how do we kind of reimagine the buildings and equip them to be better at cooling, more efficient at cooling in the long term so we're prepared for the future?
I know you've also spoken about how people in public housing are particularly vulnerable to heat-related illness and death. What's some of what you're seeing there?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that comes from the lack of investment in New York City public housing, and that's something that people have been talking about for a really long time now. And one thing that we're seeing is the disproportionate level of people of color that live in New York City public housing, first of all. So you already have sort of this level of racism that has exposed people to higher rates of chronic illness or other types of disinvestment, difficulty getting jobs, a lot of different things that systematic racism does to people. And then added to that, you have this these buildings that aren't getting upgraded to the rate that they need and aren't getting the investment that they need. So we just heard a report yesterday that there's a public housing building whose elevator just went out of power and broke down, which is a really common thing we hear from people. And what happens on a really, really hot day when an elevator in a very tall building doesn't work? Where do older, how do older adults get to their homes or leave their homes? You know, they're essentially stuck. So it's really important that we figure out how to upgrade these buildings to be prepared for things like power outages and not have all these maintenance deficiencies that lead people to kind of be exposed to heat as a bigger risk because they're maybe climbing stairs or they're stuck in their home without an AC.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, August 1st, 2020. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations, suggestions to share. The number 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Few things to get to before we get started. Wowie, what a summer it's been. So we should be in D.C. for the COWS Counter-Racist Yoga Retreat, August 5 to August 9. We have one spot, just one. If you want to join us to hang out, discounted price, one spot, just because we had one person who could not join us. So if you want to come hang out, one person, August 5 through August 9. Veggie meals, little yoga, counter racist workshops. Drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Let me know, August 5 through the 9th. That would be Wednesday through Sunday in Washington, D.C. Looking forward to it. Let's see. Lengthy list of things. The heat wave. I've been checking the weather. It had been like a part of that heat wave, I guess, aggressively hot in Washington, D.C. until like the past few days. It's looking like it will be subsiding. It had been like 100 degrees or 95, high 90s for many of the days in D.C. In July. But it's looking like it's not even going to break 90 for the time that we're there now. You know, weather forecasts and all that, they're wrong a lot, so who knows. But I've looked a few times, it's looking like it's going to be a little bit cooler, so thankfully. But even with that, all the reports about the heat wave and the dangers, environmental racism again, having black people in areas that are not energy efficient and don't have AC and have lots of asphalt and all the rest of it, all of that lost on Gus T. I had heard, seen a few reports about the heat wave in the U.S. right now, but let me double check, make sure I'm not fibbing. So the temperature in Seattle right now, 66 degrees. The average summertime temperature in Seattle, that's from June to August, the average temperature is 77 degrees. That's the average daytime high in the summer for Seattle. 77 degrees this summer, as well as last summer, I feel like it's been a little bit below that. Now, last summer, News reports said that it was right exactly as it should be. It just felt like it was a little bit cooler here last summer because there had been record heat the previous summers, like almost most of the past 10 years. It had been record highs during the summer. But last summer was back to a typical Seattle summer, so it felt a little cooler than normal, but about an average daytime high of 77. This summer, I know it's been a little bit cooler than 77 as an average because it's 66 today. And it's been a lot of days like that throughout the summer where the daytime high has been like in the high 60s or mid-70s. There just have not been a lot of days where it's been over 80. I think this week, in fact, this past week is one of the few times that I can remember where we had a number of days where it was 80 degrees, 83 degrees, and then followed by 66 today. So it's just not a really hot place here in Seattle. They say 66% of the houses here do not have air conditioning. There is a reason for that. So, hearing all the reports about the heat waves and everything, it is a little out of touch for me, but I certainly, you know, remember what it's like to be in hot, humid weather and all the rest of it with regards to racism, white supremacy, and the environmental racism component of that. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners who are down in Louisiana and Florida and New York and New Jersey and all the other places, California, Texas, I am sure that they are experiencing a whole different type of heat and humidity. So, right on. Stay hydrated. And then they had no elevators. They had that report too, having you in some high-rise building that might be 4, 5, 6 stories. They don't have an elevator in the summertime. Like, man, that's system of racism. Next, the sound clip on the cows. We've been on the air 11 and a half years at this point. Jane Elliott, I've seen her image a lot over the past few weeks or so. The New York Times had a big report with her, and she's been on all kinds of shows talking about her exercise and the ignorance of racism. Admitted racist, Jane Elliott. They don't say that. I haven't seen that in any of the reports where they talked about her, but admitted racist, Jane Elliott. Anyway, she's been on the cows 3 times. During her 3rd visit to the cows, that's when she spoke about Herman Cain. That's the audio segment that you heard as we started things off, or beginning the segment talking about the passing of Herman Cain this week, her saying that she compared him to a minstrel show and all the rest. And I was listening to that and like, wow, Jane Elliott is an admitted racist. And then just listening how she talked about Herman Cain. And this was at the time, if you go back and listen to that interview, this was like right at the time, within days of when Herman Cain dropped out of the 2012 presidential election because of all the accusations of sexual misconduct and all the rest of it. But you heard what she had to say there. And I was like, wow, that's a lot. I don't know how I feel about a white person saying all that. And then they went to the report talking about Herman Cain's passing. And they had him saying, you know, shucky ducky and all the rest of it. I was like, oh, man. Whew. Herman Cain, victim of racism. Cowbell in there, too. Victim of racism. But, yeah, he just passed away this week, they said, from the Rona. Sad. Very, very sad. Let's see. You can go back. That Jane Elliott was on the program that 3rd time in 2012. Let's see. The audio segment at the very beginning. They talked about high school sports in Texas. Just mentioned. They're going to go ahead with high school sports. They're going to try it out with their rules and regulations. I've said previously, parents, attempted parents, I would not have my offspring in athletics, no organized athletics. We're not going to be on a high school basketball team, volleyball team, wrestling team, football, none of that. I mean, lots of times you got racist coaches, and even still, that entire system is saturated, as is everything, with white supremacy, racism, and child rapists, and all the rest of it. No thanks, and we have far greater uses of our time and energy than ball games. They say down in Texas, God, guns, and high school sports, That was from the documentary film Outcry about allegations of a child athlete sexually molesting a young child. A documentary came out a few months ago during the whole Rona pandemic. It came out. It's like a 4 or 5 part series. I think it was on Netflix, but it's called Outcry. But they said God, guns, and high school football. That's the order of things in terms of priorities in the state of Texas. Wow. Let's see. The second audio segment. There are a few points in the audio clip there. So, Claudia Rankin, victim of racism, black female. She has a book of poetry about racism called Citizen. It was published within the last 5-6 years or so. We played a few segments of Claudia Rankin on the program before, and specifically the audio segment where she was asked, what do you think it will take to end racism? And she said, I don't know. We'll need a surrealist moment until white women start giving birth to black babies. And I remember that. That's the moment that I attached to Claudia Rankin. Number one, I'm not a fan of poetry. That's why our book club, we don't read poets. But I remember that interview. Again, VGQ, Victims Guaranteed Qualified. But wow, like, I thought President Barack Obama's mother was white. I thought there are a number of victims of racism who have a white mother that has not ended the system of white supremacy racism. And you hear that sort of talk all the time, that in some permutation, the cowbell, so-called interracial relationships, that will end racism. That is total nonsense. And that's what I mean. Most of the victims of racism and most of the non-white people who talk about racism, they're not logical. They're not logical. They do not have sensible responses at all. And to even have someone classified as white, accept that as an answer, and there's no interrogation. Like, what are you talking about, Ms. Rankin? I thought President Obama, at the time, President Obama, I thought his mother's white. The problem's still here. He's not the first one. What are you even talking about? That just gets, oh, wow, profound. Yes, surrealist moment. Anyway, that's what I remember about Claudia Rankin. She came to Seattle last summer, I believe, and gave a sold-out talk, and then you heard her giving her commentary there that VGQ, Victims Guaranteed Qualified, but I always attach her to that moment where she did that interview way back in 2014. Anyway, and I even compare PBS, they have a book club right now. They're reading Claudia Rankin, Citizen. Again, a book of poetry. We are never going to read a book of poetry on the book club, guaranteed. We are reading right now in the Cows Book Club, White Dog by Romaine Gary. It is in my top 10 now. I'm not pleased about it because I don't even think it's a well-written book, but wow, does it reveal a lot about what it means to be white. Wow. Fascinating read. If you are not following along in the book club, you are missing out. It is one of the best books, super informative, super instructive, set during the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. He's literally writing about the rioting, so-called, in D.C. at the time of the murder. But it is White Dog, Romaine Gary. That's what I'm way happier with our choice as opposed to Citizen, VGQ, if folks have read it and think it's constructive, right on. But I remember the moment there was a victim of racism who was on stage behind President Trump during the 2016 presidential election, and they were reading Claudia Rankin's Citizen. Now think, if a black person sitting behind President Trump during an election campaign, no less, reading White Dog. Anyway, for this here broadcast, I request if we could not use metaphors frequently. Race soldiers, white dog, what a metaphor. Frequently, race soldiers will use metaphors to practice deception. They will insist that two different concepts are exactly the same, twins, identical. Often, that is not the case at all. That is a form of master deception. victims of white supremacy, myself included, we have been exposed to this misconduct for a long time. Also, victims, myself included, many of us are still learning. As such, sometimes we don't have logic to articulate all of our views, so we will substitute a metaphor of some sort to articulate our thoughts. Frequently, this just creates more confusion. If we could be direct, speak exactly, precisely, that would be appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Thank you kindly. If we could take about 5 minutes to share our thoughts, observations, suggestions, just to make sure everyone has at least one opportunity to speak, that would be great. If you need additional time, if you could take your 5 minutes, and then you can pause, let other folks speak, and then we should have additional time for other folks to share again. Also, if you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be great. Just make sure that we don't have to deal with unnecessary audio disruptions. Number again, 720-716-7300, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Good evening, Gus, and good evening to all the callers and listeners. I don't know. I think I might have misheard you or not, but you said cowbell with Herman Cain. I believe Herman Cain's wife is a non-white black female. But you know, if you didn't say that, then you know, my apologies. But yeah, I believe Herman Cain was married to a black female. But in regards to Herman Cain, this week he died unfortunately from the coronavirus, and black people, you know, they're victims, you know, basically, you know, basically kind of doing anti-black stuff in regards to Herman Cain, you know, calling them all kind of names and sort of, especially on social media, you know, basically because of the fact that, you know, he calls himself a conservative Republican, but anytime a victim of racism dies, you know, it is tragic, and it is part of what the system wants. But, you know, Herman Cain's death also should serve as, you know, a cautionary, you know, as a caution to taking this pandemic seriously. You know, it's not known that if he caught the coronavirus at the Trump rally, but he, you know, apparently he died from it, so... this is serious, so I'm assuming people should understand now the severity of this virus. The numbers in the United States have gone to 150,000 deaths, the most in the world. So, you know, people should be very, very careful of this, especially if you're in the so-called hot spots in the United States. Earlier this week, Operation Legend, where Trump has sent federal troops, particularly here, I mean, not federal troops, but federal agents from the FBI, DEA, tobacco and firearms here in Chicago. 23 more arrests have been made. Apparently, they arrested a guy named Daryl Williams, I believe that's his name, on the street. They call him Murder. He's supposed to be the supposed leader of the Black Disciples. Now, these arrests have been made early in the week. I think 24 guns have been taken off the streets, and tons of drugs have been taken off the streets, but yet, yesterday and today, 20 people have been shot. Unfortunately, a 9-year-old boy, non-white black male, has died from gunshots. So they arrest all these people, but yet the shooting is still going on here in Chicago. And last, Bill Clinton, the former race chief in charge, not suspected racist, but a racist, speaking at the funeral of John Lewis, took some time to disparage Kwame Ture, also known as Stokely Carmichael, saying that when John Lewis gave up the leadership of SNCC, it was led by Kwame Ture, and SNCC kind of lost his way with Kwame Ture. So kind of not surprised, you know, of his, you know, Bill Clinton being a racist, but at the same time, you know, what do you expect from Bill Clinton? So I think I had one more thing, but that's all I have right now in my life.
Glad you have not been kidnapped, Henry, in Chicago. Real quick, was it a white woman that accused Herman Cain of sexual misconduct, or was the accuser a non-white female, if you know?
I'm not sure about that.
Okay. I appreciated his wife being a black female, but I think he might have had a white female accuser. But I'll double check to be sure. Always strive for accuracy. I'll double check. We talked about Bill Clinton and his antics. Man, doesn't Bill Clinton get the clown at more Negro funerals? I mean, talk about necrophilia. Like, they should have a picture of Bill Clinton right there. That's Muhammad Ali, Dr. Maya Angelou, Madiba, Nelson Mandela. It's a link, Coretta Scott King. It's a lengthy list. It's a lengthy, like, any prominent black person in the last quarter century, I bet Bill Clinton was there. I don't remember Michael Jackson's funeral, but I'd be willing to put a nickel down that Bill Clinton was probably there. He gets the clown. And we talked about that yesterday because Romaine Gary talks trash. That's a metaphor. Romaine Gary had a lot of disparaging comments to make about Stokely Carmichael, now Kwame Ture, even though he's passed. But he also didn't like Stokely Carmichael and had lots of nasty things to say about him at that time. We just talked about that yesterday. Bill Clinton, I hope. I can't imagine it happening in any way, but there can be no way Bill Clinton is allowed to speak at my homegoing services. Like, that cannot happen. Like, you know, you can have my total permission to break up the ceremony, anything that needs to be done, name call. Like, Bill Clinton cannot say a word. People should start putting that in writing. If you're prominent in any way, you start to sell some records or whatever it is, Bill Clinton, we don't want his offspring, Hillary Clinton, nobody to say a word at the service. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if we missed you totally, proceed.
Hello, can I be heard?
Is this Silent Warrior?
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. I just wanted to make sure we get our obligatory time stamp. So 4:43 a.m. in Norway. Proceed, Silent Warrior. Are you there, Solomon? We were hearing you, and now we're not hearing you. Hello? Hello? Solomon, were you? Are you there? Okay. We're not hearing you. It just sounds like background noise or something. Let's see. We'll give you a second to sign a kit. See if you can get the audio figured out. I don't know if it's your mic issue. We were hearing you. I was hearing you crystal clear. I did the timestamp, and then your volume disappeared. While we're waiting to figure it out, Silent Warrior, if there was some interference or something, some of the other folks who have a hand up, do you have commentary to share?
Yes, can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to everyone. First wanted to start off with a tragic announcement. Daughter of a lady that I know was shot to death in a house. The killer or killers through shooting through the house killed her. She was pregnant, and in turn the child was delivered and is in critical condition in itself. The mother of the deceased was a supporter of myself and Mr. Clark during the earlier days when we were trying to in South Florida in our, I put it this way, in our counter-racist efforts in the 1980s. She was a supporter and just found out that her 30-year-old daughter died due to a gunshot wound. I've been thinking all this week about the faction of someone who has evidently has if you have influence over a lot of people, I think it would be incorrect to influence them to strap a firearm on and participate with you in ventures of parading around with a firearm. If someone is thinking about something other than self-defense, then that's something that should be a personal venue. That's the only constructive venue, I think, that type of issue should take place, and it should be highly personal. And I'm talking about maximum emergency compensatory action. I am not going to talk about it. I would just suggest that if anybody wants to know what that is, then buy or read in Mr. Fuller's book, Under the People Activity of War. Athletics in Texas. Yes. It is a multi-million dollar business that's controlled by white people. So just like any other white-controlled business, they would like to get it functioning back to what it was despite this pandemic. For the most part, the people who they're making money off of is black male bodies. The recruiting process nowadays starts before a non-white black male is a teenager. It starts before then. And white males primarily, but I would say white people in general, make millions of dollars in that process. And that's all I have to say. Thanks everybody for listening. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. White people in Texas, let me say it again the way they said it. That documentary, again, is Outcry. Just came out a few weeks ago. They said in Texas, it's God, the religion of white supremacy, guns, high school sports. Wow. Okay, let's try again. Let's see. Silent Warrior, I think we have him with us again. Let's try and see if his line is working correctly. I thought I saw him, and then
Don't send. I thought his line was right there. Well, we'll look again. Silent Warrior, once we get it figured out with your line, or ring back in, and we'll get you on immediately to share your thoughts, observations. In the meantime, other folks who dialed in that we have missed totally, if you have commentary, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, Thomas in New York.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers. I'll get right into it. I got a few notes here. Disarm the police from non-lethal weapons like beanbags, light flashes, rubber bullets, and tasers. And several pretty much all white cities like Minneapolis, Seattle, and Portland. But the protesters are using blinding laser lights, professional-grade fireworks, kerosene and gasoline balloons, batteries, bricks, bottles, Molotov cocktails, and twin shots with ball bearings. The news isn't reporting none of this. How come the news, the mainstream media, isn't showing this? Not here. You know, I don't know about in those places, but they're making it seem like these are peaceful protesters and how dare he send in the troops. And it's like, are you serious? Now, federal officers in riot gear are not federal troops. Federal troops are called the Army and the Marines. That's who he needs to send into those cities to take control. Boston Marathon bomber, I'm not even going to try to pronounce his name. In Russia, they're considered Chechenian black people. But here, they're white. They rescinded the death penalty for him. Three dead, several people injured, including 14 amputees. I guess he doesn't deserve to die for that. They made sure they didn't rescind John Muhammad's death sentence. He's dead now, and technically, all he did was drove around the car. You know, rest in peace to Herman Cain, black male, black wife, black college. Pillsbury elevated him to CEO of their failing, nearly bankrupt Godfather pizza brand, and he made it profitable enough for them to sell it. Prior to that, he worked for their Burger King brand when they owned that. Hated by many, if not most, black people for simply not being a racist Democrat. You know, how dare he be a conservative? And as far as the sexual allegations, it was white women, a Jewish woman. And then they dragged out a few other white women, too. He was like the first Bill Cosby. But none of those was proven. Sort of like Kavanaugh. Could have been made up. San Francisco, a.k.a. Silicon Valley, most expensive city in the nation to live in. Got homeless people living in tents. They use Nightscope robots to patrol the tech firm campuses for homeless people. They have introduced the Karen Act, named after the white woman who went after the bird watcher. They changed the C, the K in Karen to C, and it's an acronym for Caution Against Racially Exploitive Non-Emergencies. So this is, they're trying to push for this to become a law in San Francisco, where they have homeless people all over the place. Grandmaster Jay, not Jam Master Jay, Grandmaster Jay, leader of the NFAC, the Not Effing Around Coalition. I consider him to be extremely dangerous. I would refrain from watching his videos and commenting on them, thumb up in them or liking them. This could be potentially a 2020 version of COINTELL, and I say this only because he only exists in social media. He's being used as social media propaganda. After what I saw in Louisville last week where people got shot, in Georgia the month earlier, his pro-black and anti-white discourse, when he has the microphone in his mouth, his armed militia getting police protection and political support, he's barely mentioned in the mainstream media. I mean, Tucker Carlson missing this guy, Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, how are all these people on Fox News with all their journalists. I mean, come on. They're missing this guy. It's not by this. This is by design. So I say he's extremely dangerous. He's being used for something. You know, we might find out what it is, but terrible. Congressman John Lewis, I watched his dead body being driven over the Edmund Pettus Bridge for the last time. That's a form of white supremacy symbolism. Let's drive him over the bridge where we bashed his head in on it. Then they took him to D.C., blew him, drove him to President Lincoln's memorial stops. Another form of white symbolism, you know, that good old Lincoln. Then they drove him to the Black Lives Matter street stop. Very symbolic. That's where he gave his speech calling for white gay men to get civil rights a couple of weeks ago. Dr. Welzin talks about gestures of white supremacy symbolism. And I think that whole thing, including the fact that his casket was wrapped in the American flag, was all white supremacy symbolism. And we have the Black Lives Matter street in New York in front of Trump Tower. And every day people then go out there, they throw paint on the sign, and they wait to get arrested. And they have a group of people standing by with yellow paint to repaint it instantly. It's just terrible. And that's all I got to say for now. Thank you, guys.
Context of white supremacy. Okay, so at least it get a little bit of information about the Herman Cain accusers, cowbell. That's about what I thought. let's see. I think we have Silent Warrior with us, should be. So let's give it a try again. Silent Warrior, live in Norway. Are you with us, sir?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Perfect. Thank you. I've just called a couple of times. I've written some things down. Bill Clinton putting down a black male who fought against racism at the funeral of a black male who fought against racism. That's my comment on that. What's this focus on reinstating ball games by the NBA and other leagues? With the economy down and white anxiety is up, ball games allow whites to return to the psychological play of the control of the balls, the colored balls, especially during these times of protest against racism, white supremacy. In Dr. Welton's chapter in the ISIS papers, Ball Games as Symbols, she states that play and games then become the child's unconscious attempt to master the environment, its conflicts, and the threats to the child's sense of security. And this rush to reinstate the ball games pandemic, I look at it as the way the system is helping to focus the attention of the white collective on keeping their eye on the ball. I apologize if that's a metaphor. Which is a matter of life and death in the system of white supremacy in terms of maintaining white genetic survival. So that's on ball games. I came across an article called The Wages of Woke about the white fragility author. It talked about the wealth that she's accumulated and that she may not be donating a portion of it to non-white people as she claims to be. But what was most relevant for me was the statement about the actual effectiveness of her work. It said, a review of nearly 1,000 studies of anti-bias tools found little evidence that they have any impact. In fact, recent studies suggest anti-bias training's primary effect may be to encourage discrimination. Firms with diversity training end up with fewer minorities in management. And field research finds that training both reinforces stereotypes and increases animosity against minority groups. That's all I have to contribute. Thank you.
All
and it's 5 o'clock in the morning. Forget that time stamp in.
Global system. Context of white supremacy. Much obliged. I've heard that type of report before where they said, hey, we looked at the analysis of what happens after they have this so-called anti-bias training or sensitivity training or whatever it is, and it seems like they tell a few more nigger jokes and don't really hire any more black people. Like, this is not really helping to solve the problem. The few times that they have, you know, reported on whether or not this is effective at all, which obviously it is not. Number again, 720-716-7200, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. My condolences to a retired firefighter and mother who lost her child. Man, it has been a catastrophic year from beginning all the way to the beginning of August. Absolutely catastrophic. I will say before we get our next callers, codification, I think we had just talked about that. When it comes to firearms, that requires extraordinary codification. Not just random and some kind of way and being reckless and I'm upset. Extraordinary codification. I even pointed out Mr. Fuller's section on war, at least in his first edition, I'd have to double check for his edited version, but for the first edition, the chapter on war was the longest section, chapter, in the book. There is a reason for that. It is very detailed. You're not just sloppy, and that's why. We're trying to stop black people being harmed, not pick up a gun so that we can just go out and harm more black people. If you, and I'd say folks who listen to Mr. Fuller over some years, that seems to be one thing that he does not have a whole lot of tolerance for, violence against black people, even if it's other black people being violent with other black people. Like, that's what we are supposed to be stopping altogether. Doesn't matter who's committing it. No harming of black people, really no harming of anybody, but particularly no harming black people. At least that's something that I've noted, particularly him talking about his time living in D.C. and that sort of thing, like zero tolerance for mistreating other black people. *61 for folks who would like to participate. People that we have missed totally, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
May I speak freely? Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I've been reading some black masculinist studies by T. Hassan Johnson, and I'd like, and other than Tommy Curry in the archive, are there any other resources that the call might have on this topic?
That was all you wanted to make sure you got.
Yeah, I'm asking. I know we got Tommy Curry on the archives, and black masculinist studies is what Tommy Curry is really a specialist on. But do we have anyone else? Do we have, for example, T. Hassan Johnson?
No, he has not been a guest on the program. I'm aware of his work. I think I was just looking at one of his reports on black misandry. But no, he has not been a guest on the program.
might be a good person to chat it up with. I have not reached out to him.
I think his work and Dr. Tommy Corey's work is really resourceful. It's really useful for me because I'm beginning to see examples of Black misandry throughout my past life for decades that I always felt uncomfortable about but never had the vocabulary to identify. So I'll be using the archives with Dr. Tommy Corridge, with the interviews that you have with him. That guy's a genius. One thing I've gotten from the calls recently is the wealth of material that there is to study. There's a lot of work, a lot of study to be done. I mute my line.
Much obliged, caller in Norway, Silent Warrior. Tommy Curry, Dr. Tommy Curry's The Man That is in the book club as well. We'll have to get Dr. Hassan on the broadcast. It is important sometimes just having a turn concept can greatly help you articulate things. Not hanging out particularly today because my voice is not well and we have the retreat looming. So not hanging out for folks to spectate today. Either you have commentary or we will gleefully look forward to ending a little bit early because there's a lot to do. And certainly this is not a time where it's not like there's nothing happening and nothing to comment on. The number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Isabel Wilkerson has a new book. She authored The Warmth of Other Suns. That is in my top 10, also in the book club. I can't say I was excited. Now, this could be similar to Harriet A. Washington, Medical Apartheid, in my top 10. I saw A Terrible Thing to Waste, but I wasn't really excited. Like, oh, we should read that right now, and that's probably going to be great, too, and kind of waited around. We didn't wait that long, but I didn't read it immediately. I wasn't excited about it, and it turns out that book now is in my top 10 as well. She has two. So her new book is called Cased. Now, that was one reason why I was not very excited. It's supposed to examine white supremacy racism in terms of how Nazis, Adolf Hitler, treated Jews. Now, that might be one reason to read because Dr. Weldon would say, you should be reading things about Nazi Germany. But it also talks about the treatment of the darkest people in India. I forgot their name, but mistreatment of them and mistreatment of Negros in the U.S. That's what the whole book is about. Cast. C-A-S-T-E. New book just came out. It might have been today, or at least within the past couple of days. But the lovely Isabel Wilkerson, she's absolutely gorgeous. The Warmth of Other Suns is spectacular, right up there with White Dog, but for different reasons. In the book club, you can go back and I think some of the people probably, you know, heard absolutely amazing. I gloat on it all the time, lots of references. But she does have a brand new book. It is about racism, white supremacy, but I can't say I'm excited about it. Maybe I need to read a little bit. Reading, more important than watching television. Are there folks we missed totally?
May I be heard?
I can hear you, sir.
Oh.
Can I be heard, or was that someone else?
Oh, yes. Yes, sir, we can hear you.
Oh, thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I wanted to start out with they had a funeral here in the city where I'm at, a 9-year-old black female child passed away from COVID-19, and they're still talking about what they're going to do for opening schools. And it's just interesting that apparently they have lawsuits, I guess, going towards certain universities for people who are being told not to come to campus. So just once again, another example of the disorganization, the incompetence of how this area of the world has responded to the situation. There was another incident that was reported here locally where a black male was, of course, mistreated by race soldiers. And, you know, as they were interviewing him, he just said that, "I have PTSD from this. I've had to get on medication. You know, I can't sleep at night. I'm scared to go out of my house. You know, I'm afraid of officers." And they ended the segment saying that the officer that was accused of this got his job back, or they put him on desk duty or something like that. So just more disregard for black life. And as far as the sports, they projected that University of Florida, I guess, could lose out on $470 million, but they can't let the fans come to the games. So the economic impact, white people, I bet, definitely are focused on that. And it's just sad, the victim of racism, the mayor of Atlanta, has to be attacked like that by racist, I think his name, Governor Kemp. Just totally unnecessary. Like, she's using logic to help save people, you know, to keep people safe and everything. And he's just causing more problems, more issues. And that's pretty much all I have to share right now. And thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, caller in Florida, Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms. I said it's been a rough summer for she and her family. I think she, her husband, at least one of her children, I think they might have said it was more than one of her children, had COVID-19, sued by the governor, threatened by race soldiers. Remember, they were calling, leaving her messages, calling her a nigger and everything for the same thing, you know, putting in restrictions and asking people to shelter in place and wear masks and social distance. Like, what a rough year. I do not imagine it getting any better if she ends up being the VP pick for Mr. Biden. Don't know if that's going to happen or not, but I don't see that improving things for Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms. I could be incorrect about that. Did you say at the beginning it was a young child who died, a 9-year-old? Is that what you said? Or maybe I didn't hear that correctly.
Yes, sir. 9-year-old black female child. They've been showing the story on the local news, and they had her funeral today here locally. They said that she's the youngest victim of COVID here in Florida, apparently.
Wow. It has been a rough year and lots of losses this year. Take it seriously. And even to have that, and that's what I said, now you contrast that with, take your pick, you can contrast that with they have a bubble in Orlando because basketball is that important. Any of them, the sports, really. Dr. Welling said keep your eye on the ball game. Or you can contrast that with Texas. They say we got to have football come September. Or I don't know, maybe August, because, I mean, sometimes the football practice and all that stuff starts before school. So, I mean, it might be
right now, you know, Monday, you know, we got to get out here and do these practices and all the rest. I mean, I contrast that. That's absurd. Take it seriously. Take it seriously. We for sure will be taking it seriously during the retreat, but take it seriously. Distancing, washing your hands, like avoiding big groups and crowds and that sort of thing. Stay in. You don't have to be out and about, that sort of thing. Take it seriously. Like, man, it's ridiculous. Yeah, take it serious. Take it serious. Make sure I get in as well, since we were mentioning books. Mumia Abu-Jamal. Oh, they did. I was going to say that. Thomas in New York was talking about the, I think they pronounce it the Zarnaya brothers. Might be close. Zarnaya brothers. With the Boston Marathon bombing. And we talked about that. We did a whole program about whether or not they're accepted as white. Now, they did reject Mumia's death sentence eventually. So just because they remove a death sentence doesn't necessarily, you know. Anywho, Mumia Abu-Jamal, whole reason I mentioned him, the segment that we played today, he referenced authors and historians, Ishaka Musa Barashango. We played audio segments from him before. I have some of his books sitting right on my bookshelf right now. I can reach out and grab them. And Laron Bennett Jr., the great Laron Bennett Jr., publisher. He authored Before the Mayflower. He also authored Forced into Glory. Now, we had Thomas in New York just mentioned Abraham Lincoln. That is a spectacular, I mean, five-star biography on Abraham Lincoln, written by Laron Bennett Jr. You can go to C-SPAN, and he did like a three-hour talk on the book. Like, it is, it has racist jokes in it and everything. It is absolutely spectacular. And the main thesis being Abraham Lincoln is a racist. And let me give you the detail. That's why I said it's got racist jokes in it. Five-star effort. Laron Bennett Jr., I've mentioned it before on the program, the only reason we haven't read it on the book club is because it's too long. I think it would probably, I mean, like months. It's kind of, I mean, but it is worth, it will hold your attention. Racist jokes, man, come on. It is spectacular. Laron Bennett Jr., Forced into Glory, biography on Abraham. But he's written lots of material. That's why Mumia Abu-Jamal had high commendations for both. Ishaka Musa Barashango, Laron Bennett Jr., other folks have commentary that they want to get in. The number 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Folks, we missed totally. If you have a hand up, proceed.
Good evening. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, everyone. I think you mentioned something about dark-skinned Indians earlier. I think, could be incorrect, I think that they're called Dalits or the Untouchables. And I know that today, my background, I was born in Jamaica. Today is day 11, yeah, today. August 1st is known as Emancipation Day. And I finally got to read that article on the slave hands, the slave dogs. And it mentioned the Maroon War. And for some reason, I don't know if I didn't learn about it in school or what, but I had to do like a Jamaican history refresher. And it just happened that what I did coincided with today, which is what they call Emancipation Day. And when I went into, I guess, the history of the Emancipation Day thing, I read that emancipation was granted August 1st, 1834, but only children 6 years and under were quote-unquote free. Everyone else, they said, they didn't even call them slaves. They said they worked 40 hours without pay. what else? Yeah, and the Maroon War. So growing up in Jamaica, the Maroons were always, for me, I always, the image I had of the Maroons where they were freedom fighters, escaped from slavery, going into the mountains, building a community, and stuff like that. And, but even, let me just mention this real quick, but even the word Maroon, I don't think it was the actual Maroons that called themselves Maroons, you know. I think they were named by Europeans, and it was like a play on the Maroons, because to be Maroon means to be trapped on an island somewhere, right? And I was reading, I even saw like some slave ship called like Royal African something. I'm like, you know, these Europeans are using these like, you know, Royal and Nubian and all that stuff, but it's still derogatory. But anyways, going back to the Maroons, yeah, I didn't know that they were basically slave catchers. Yeah, so I learned that. And, big props up to Gus and the investor that shared that article, because it was really, really, really interesting. And trying to read that, the one on police brutality. And I think, yeah, I hope I'm not forgetting anything like I usually do, but I think that's it. Thanks for letting me share.
Much obliged. Global system, again. Yeah, that the report that she's referencing, Slave Hounds in Abolition in the Americas, I guess this week, Dr. Tyler Perry, P-A-R-R-Y, was a white person, or not even suspected, race soldier. Cowbell there, too. That report is extremely informative, and he talks in great detail, not just about the white dogs' use in the United States, but throughout the Caribbean, Haiti, Jamaica, Santo Domingo, lots of black boys. Wherever they had Negroes, got to have the slave at Cuba, wherever you, like what I just say, wherever we got the Negroes, got to have the slave dog. Nigger dogs, that's what they call it. I hadn't even heard that before. We got nigger dogs. We bred them specifically to chomp on the Negro. Black males, you know, Black misandry again. We talked about that with Dr. Tyler D. Perry. *61, if folks have commentary to get in. I forgot. They had the commentary sending the federal troops. Henry in Chicago talked about that. Thomas in New York about that. They might be sending troops here to Seattle. Hopefully they'll do it while I'm gone. And then they'll be gone by the time I get back. They had a report on NPR, I just forgot that it was, I had, you know, not since the Rona came out, but it was just like 2 days ago, and they said, wow, we could have street wars unfold before summer's end. I said, street wars? What is that? And they said, well, we've got these armed federal officers, and then a lot of the protest with Thomas and New York, we got a lot of these protesters, they're armed. So we could potentially see gun battles in the street before year's end. It's an election year, and they're talking about, you know, shenanigans with the election. They would delay it and all the rest of that. Street wars predicted for 2020. They were talking about shooting people over toilet paper, and now just gun battle just because. The number, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. It's been such a terrible year. I feel like we've had lots of reports of death for all kinds of lots of it, unnecessary, just totally unnecessary deaths reported this year for all kinds of reasons. Other folks have commentary they want to make sure they get in.
May I be heard?
I hear you.
I can hear you.
Oh, okay. All right. I just wanted to mention on Herman Cain, on that segment where I think that they were asking if he knew the president of some country, I guess. I can't really remember the name of it.
that sounded so random. Like, I don't even remember them asking any of the white candidates that question. And it seemed like it was codified, in my opinion, where he said, do you happen to know who the president is? When he was asked that question, I like how he asked the question back. And it reminded me of another act of racism where, Gus, I know you'll be repulsed by this, but I think the guy named Rick Perry, white man, racist suspect, he kept using the term brother to Herman Cain, I believe. This was a couple years ago. I think he said it like twice on a debate stage. Racism once again. And that's all I wanted to mention.
Huh. Now I feel like by 2012, much obliged caller in Florida, I had started to pay attention to the news pretty regularly by then, because I was not. I was like a lot of the other folks who said, man, that's, you know, only lames read the newspaper. You know, they just lie, you know, or read the newspaper. That was what they added to, or just the lazy people who, you know, just don't do that. But I was in that group prior to being serious about white supremacy, racism. About 2012, I was pretty serious. So I remember watching. That was Mitt Romney, all that. I remember Moochers. I remember a lot of that leading up to two. Were they calling him brother? Rick Perry specifically, was he calling him brother a lot? That seems like man, I would have. That seems like the type of thing I would have, you know, made me nauseous if I had to keep sitting through Brother King. Brother King, like, wow. I was like, come on now. Come on. Come on. You're not, especially if you're not calling anybody else brother, if I'm just going to be brother for some odd reason. Like, woo. Victim, Herman Cain. Let's see. And that's a great codified response as well from the debate, them asking him some wacky question and him being able to respond with a question. I feel like they try to do that sort of thing, try and embarrass you and make you seem like you're not qualified and don't know what you're talking about, that sort of thing. I can relate to that completely. Let's see. Other folks have commentary that they wanted to make sure they get in.
Can I be heard?
Henry in Chicago? Yes, sir.
All right. BGQ for me. I have been watching the NBA restart, and I don't know if this is a metaphor, but I know you use this, Gus. I mean, clown show in regards to the Black Lives Matter painted on the court, all these commercials about, you know, ending racism. And what was so interesting was, I believe, the NBA has a commercial with Issa Rae talking about the NBA restart. And, you know, ironically, you know, you talked about this on your show, she has a season of her, Insecure show on HBO where she talks about toxic black male masculinity. And so, you know, it's ironic. She does a commercial for a sport that has 90% black males playing in it. So, you know, not just the NBA. You know, I just saw something on hockey where they're doing some Black Lives Matter thing as well, and baseball. And I'm pretty sure football is going to do the same thing. And, you know, I don't even know if football is going to be playing this year. But, you know, obviously the races, you know, they're going to want their football. So they're probably going to try to, you know, push it forward no matter what happens. You know, half the league can be infected, but they'll still play the sport. But that's all I wanted to add right now and get my line.
Much obliged. VGQ, if it brings you with all of the death and catastrophe that this year has brought, if you can get any enjoyment. Even that, you can't even watch the NBA. Half of the season they spent mourning Kobe Bryant and, you know, all the rest of it. So, yeah, if you can get some enjoyment from that, right on. But that would even sour it for me now. If I got to sit through this and they're going to have all these tacky shenanigans that they're going to wheel Jane Elliott out at halftime and let her give a little talk and have Black Lives Matter stenciled on the come on. Does Bill Clinton, does he get to come out and give a speech to and tell his best stories with John Lewis? Come on. And then we just talked about, maybe we need to get Dr. Hassan, see if we can get him on soon. Dragging my feet, but that's a metaphor. I was kind of not having a sense of urgency about speaking with him, but Silent Warrior mentioned this, maybe I should get on that quicker. But I mean, man, we're supposed to be talking seriously about white supremacy racism, and then we didn't have a whole season devoted to white supremacy racism. We didn't have a whole season devoted to toxic white femininity. We got a whole season in a world with nigger dogs that are trained to just attack black males. We got a whole season about toxic black masculinity. And she was in The Hate U Give. I noted that. They'll bring her into real important projects to talk about racism, ostensibly, where black people are dying and being shot and all the rest of it. VGQ there, too. Did other folks have commentary that they wanted to share? That is so, because they just were talking with the whole sports restart. I think it was the Marlins, the Florida Marlins baseball team. I think they just had like 19 players test positive. I was like, are you serious? who is seriously looking at this like, yeah, in the middle of all this, I need to see a good ball game. Oh, that's just the best thing. Why can't we get some folks to go and touch each other and breathe real hard and get close to each other? Like, that's just the best idea ever right now. System of racism, Dr. Welsing, eyes on the ball games. Caller, no, I thought that made a lot of sense in saying white people will give them some comfort, be able to see where, in at least one context, they still have control over non-white balls. That can give them some comfort. Other folks have commentary they wanted to share?
Yes, can I be heard?
Caller in, yes, I just said, caller in Florida, near the bubble.
Yes, I have been a part of five state of Florida high school football state championships. One has been a national championship. In the process of that national championship, we had to travel to Dallas, Texas, to play a privately owned, predominantly white high school football team. And in the state of Texas, there are coaches, white males, who, I'm not talking about their teacher salary, but they are stipend six figures as far as payment that they get coaching football. This indicates the level of importance that they place sports and football. There was also a point in time when the Dallas Cowboys, NFL Dallas Cowboys, needed a temporary facility to be able to hold their fall camp, and the fall camps are starting right now. They felt very comfortable at utilizing one of these white private high schools, because the facilities itself was as luxurious as one of these Division I colleges, is what I'm saying. So they hold that particular institution very high, and like I said before, the most exploited individuals within that business is black males. One thing that I wanted to, you know, kind of like get someone else's opinion is the word uprising. I've heard the word itself for a long time. The word itself has been coming up recently over the past maybe 3 or 4 months. The first thing that come to my mind is to use the word with caution. And just thinking about whatever anybody else would have to say about the word uprising.
Hmm.
That's interesting. Retired firefighter. It is, oh, certainly. Big business, and it's not like they're giving out stipends to the players. Any of those high school players or even Division One players, they've been rather stingy about wanting to give them a nickel or even a chicken sandwich, because they said a lot of the black players have given reports for decades where they've been playing and winning championships and all that and starving, didn't even have a saltine cracker. Anyway, with the starving athlete with uprising in that term, that's interesting because I would have to, because they have like a whole podcast called Uprising Radio. That's KPFK in California, I believe, non-white people. I do hear frequently instead situations that would be called a so-called riot. I do sometimes hear uprising used in its place, the L.A. uprising, the Rodney King uprising, that's the Ferguson uprising. I've heard that sort of language. I don't tend to use that word, just thinking about it. Yeah, I don't tend to use that word, uprising. If I do, it's either I'm referencing like the radio uprising radio, or I'm referencing someone else using that sort of terminology. But yeah, I don't tend to use that word. I wouldn't even know how to explain. Like if somebody asked me, Gus, what does uprising mean? And that's all I could say is it's generally used to mean some sort of disturbance with people. Generally where they're being unruly, it might be a lot of people where they might not be following rules or causing a disturbance of some sort. But yeah, I guess I now that I'm thinking about it, I don't often hear the word uprising applied to white people. I'll put it that way. Like, when they had like Occupy Wall Street and those type things, or environmental movements when they're out doing that, I don't generally hear them say like, oh man, we had, you know, an uprising down in Wall Street, and a number of protesters were out with signs and talking about the one that, like, I don't remember that sort of language being used. It seems like that's the sort of language that's just applied to black people. But other people, thoughts on uprising? If anybody uses that term, you should definitely share. But other people with thoughts on the word uprising?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm looking at the dictionary on Google, and it says that uprising is an act or instance of rising up, especially usually localized act of popular violence in defiance, usually of an established government. So I don't know if that makes any clear. I'm not sure what popular violence means.
Sounds
terrible. I'm so sorry. Do I sound any better now?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. So it says, the definition of uprising, an act or instance of rising up, especially a usually localized act of popular violence in defiance, usually, of an established government. I'm not sure what popular violence means in this definition, but that's the definition that I got from Merriam-Webster's dictionary.
That's close to my understanding of the word, although I don't use it, but that's every time I've heard it, it's associated with something very close to what you read. But what it tells me in my brain computer, that is something that is not permanent, and I have not studied anything in history where it was something that was constructive and resulted into something constructive, put it that way. But I hear the word a lot, and it's spoken in a way that this is something that I'm supposed to do, or a group of people are supposed to do.
Can I be heard?
Yes,
I can hear you. All right. I'm looking at the Merriam-Webster's dictionary, and uprising is
a usually violent effort by many people to change the government or leader of a country. Now, if you can show me an army commanded by non-white people who is a threat to the army of this nation, then I would use that word uprising. Other than that, I see no use of using it.
Interesting.
Can I be heard?
In Chicago. Thomas in New York? Yes, sir.
Yeah, I use the word quite often on purpose as a part of my codification to not use the word riot when it pertains to black people. I call it an uprising because that's all y'all doing is uprising, you know, making a bunch of noise. Y'all not really going to do nothing. Like, now, what I saw in Minneapolis, that was a riot. But I saw in Portland and Seattle, those were riots. Like, we don't do that. You know, so we have uprisings. We go to the street, we march. I use it as a term generally when I'm speaking to someone who's less codified, and they use riot, and I start using uprising, they might ask why, and then I'm able to explain why riots are, you know, that's why I use it. But I do understand why people wouldn't use it. I just don't think riot is the correct term. When black people are upset and decide they're going to take to the streets and do something, I call it an uprising. You know, it's not a riot, you know. And I had one more thing to say, but I'll mute my mouth now.
Any other thoughts on the term uprising? I know Thomas in New York has other topics. Any other thoughts on the term uprising? Be mindful of who that term is applied to. Like I said, I don't think that's one that gets applied to white people too often. Generally, they're talking about black people, so-called. Let's see. Thomas in New York, did you want to get your other thought in now?
Yeah, generally when white people do it, it's called the coup, where they go to taking over things. But I just wanted to say, man, I watched on TV this week, and, you know, the way that the country does business has changed from industrialization to surveillance, surveillanceization, per se. So the tech barons, the surveillance people, were at Congress this week. They had Facebook CEO, Google, Amazon, and Apple CEO at the House of Representatives. And they were, you know, using very slick tactics to not answer questions or using a code where they give a very vague answer and not narrowing down their answer, so it's something that they can't be held to later. None of them would speak bad about China, except for Zuckerberg, for obvious reasons, because they don't let Facebook in China. But one thing came out, Google software is in Chinese fighter pilot yet. Like, wow. You know, but they seem to be missing Microsoft and Oracle. And I said, man, they could have left off Apple and Facebook because between Microsoft, Amazon, Google, and Oracle, that's the cloud. So that's where everybody's data is stored, and they have it, you know, possession of it until you access it or whoever you get permission to access it. So they're really the big data companies. So the fact that they left those two off let me know that this wasn't going to be anything that was really serious. None of them would admit to not interfering in the election using their technology. But the sad thing is that these are the people that's controlling the information now. And the tech companies have slowly taken over all the media companies. Bezos owns the Washington Post, CNN. Is owned by AT&T now, a tech company. New York Times is owned by Carlos Slim, a tech mogul from Mexico. He has everything AT&T has. He runs Mexican telecom. ABC is Disney. Disney's long been a tech company, especially in visual technology. And you got Comcast, who owns NBC now. And
No, let's not forget their news channel is called Microsoft NBC, MSNBC. So the tech barons is in control now. Used to be GE in charge of, you know, back when we had industrialization. You know, that was a Rockefeller company. But now it's Microsoft. So very dangerous for the people who have all our information are also giving us our news. It's, you know, this is like, wow. You know, so a lot of what I'm seeing in the news is not news, it's propaganda. And you can kind of see when you go from social media news to the newspaper news to alternative news, you know, and they're trying to take alternative, they're getting rid of their competition, taking off the Federalist, taking off Zero Hedge, taking off Breitbart. Like, they don't want any other competition but them, you know, as far as giving news. It's very dangerous. And the Congress, I doubt they're going to do anything about it. They alluded to it, but this is their largest campaign donors. So, I mean, really, it was just a show. And I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Can I be heard?
Hey, Bart. So you missed totally.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings, calls and listeners. Pardon, I got in a little late on the call, so I missed a lot of the compensatory call in, but I really am going to give a listen to it tomorrow. But I've really been trying to catch up with White Dog, and I'm trying to find this book at a reasonable price. And I mean, if any callers or anybody can find a way to get it, PDF or anything, I've been seriously looking on the internet, especially after the interview that you had with Dr. Perry, I believe. Really interesting. I also found his conversation, well, his information about the West Indies, so-called West Indies, about the Maroon Indians, really an extremely important point. My grandmother is actually a Maroon, and she stated that they're still living in Jamaica, although some of them were shipped away due to the constant rebellions that they were having, well, constant fighting they were having on the island with the so-called white people. So there are still towns in Jamaica that are called Maroon towns scattered around the island that are separate, actually, from the actual, from the government. They kind of given their own land and their own area in which they mainly inhabit. I'm still learning things about this from speaking to my grandmother, by the way. Also, in regards to uprising,
we were picking up some background noise. I'll give it a second or two and see if the background noise pops up. Maybe some other people came in and disrupted. I know how that can be. Trying to make a point, and then other people come in but being disruptive. Let's see if things are clear on the line again.
Yeah, I'm still here. I have no idea what that was.
Crazy.
Yes, I was trying to just get information about my son's school so he could actually stay home. I have other programs and other ways for him to socialize. I really don't want to risk him going into the school system and possibly catching the virus. We've heard from my potential partner that one of her nephew's friends in California just passed away at 13 years old from the virus. And this is the type of thing that as a parent, I just don't want to risk it. You know, I know he's going into high school. I know how important it is, but I'm going to have to withhold him and keep him home and just keep him active as possible, bike rides and whatever else we can do together, but and maybe some of his friends, but I just can't risk that. Also, in downtown Brooklyn, this is something that, just a side note, they have Ida B. Wells Lane in one of the most popular downtown areas in Brooklyn, where most non-white people go shopping. And I immediately thought to myself, just why? Like, why are you giving us this instead of giving us something more tangible? You know, and it just breeds to people, at least for myself, it feels more like an insult. Also, I have a question, and I looked this up in the Word Guide. They've been using this phrase called cancel culture lately for people that they deem, especially white liberals, they deem racist or extremists or something to that degree. They use the phrase cancel culture. And when I looked it up and I studied it from other psychologists and other things, it's basically they're just, and the term is in the Word Guide, what they've been doing to us for centuries, which is blackball them. Like, basically they're blackballing these artists or whatever, entertainers or psychologists, philosophers that they don't agree with. And obviously I've kind of thought it was interesting the fact that they're using another phrase instead of saying blackball or whitewash or anything. They're saying cancel culture. And looked it up in the Word Guide and saying, during the existence of white supremacy racism, it is correct to study all terms that include the words black or dark in order to reveal if the term is being used in a manner that directly or indirectly helps to promote thought, speech, and or action in support of white supremacy racism. I just thought that was interesting because I've been hearing the phrase quite often, and I just never heard anybody give a clear-cut definition, but it's literally synonymous with blackball. With that said, I'll mute my line. Thank you. Peace.
Much obliged, sir. Let's see. White Dog, I've talked about that, how expensive that book is, and that's significant. Talked about that this week, that we almost weren't able to read it because that book is so expensive. It's not really easily accessible, which, you know, people should think about because it's in my top 10 now that we have it. I actually have a PDF of that I think I did post on Facebook, so it should be accessible. I'll double check to make sure it's there. But yes, I have the full PDF now. We even missed a page this week. I was upset because I have the full page. A listener helped us out getting access to the book, so I had to go back. It's in the archive, complete, no missing page. But first time around, I double checked, like, oh man, I missed a page in collating the PDF of the book. But whole thing, no pages missed. Super happy to have it and didn't have to pay a shilling. Let's see. As for, so is White Dog, I do not have children, but I think that is black self-respect, taking it serious and getting resources, not wanting to risk your offspring. We just, caller in Florida was just saying that it was a 9-year-old in Florida died from COVID-19, so I think that makes all the sense in the world to say I'm not going to take a risk with my child, and just reporting a 13-year-old passed away. So, absolutely, take it seriously, and I would not mess around with their, you know, kind of hodgepodge plan for what they think the reopening could look like and trying to force children back into an unsafe situation. Take it super seriously. Cancel culture, I guess, if other folks have commentary, I'll just say real quickly, I hear often that phrasing used in a pejorative sense, and what I mean is it'll be someone classified as white. Like, I think Bill Maher, just within the past, 48 hours, I think he just did, a monologue saying, you know, we got to get rid of this cancel culture, you know. Just because Paula Deen, all right, so she said nigger. That doesn't mean we got to throw Paula Deen away forever, you know. What? All right, so Donald, what he said was reprehensible. But, I mean, who says we got to make him give up his team and, you know, he can't play basketball with some of us anymore? That's ridiculous. This cancel culture, that's the way that I hear it often, used in a pejorative sense, attached to someone who frequently has been
evidence has shown that they are racist, practice white supremacy racism, and then there end up being consequences, that will be labeled cancel culture. And it'll be like, oh,
yes.
Man, this is such a terrible thing. That's the way I hear it used most frequently, which is quite different from blackball, quite different. But, yeah, other folks, if you have if you use that term, have heard it, have thoughts, cancel culture, feel free. Or if we have other parents, because that's important, too, in terms of planning for new school year. Rapidly, like it's August. New school year is almost here.
Well, they canceled my daughter's college this year. Got her. I was holding off on making my payment for the last minute, and it paid off. So, yeah, she has to take her classes from home, which severely reduced the payment. So it was great. But either way, yeah, that's what they did. As far as cancel culture, I hate it. And this is the problem with the social media having this control, because you only get canceled on social media. You know, they cancel you on, I guess, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat, or whatever, and it trickles over into your personal career, you know. And now, he said blackballed. The mainstream doesn't pick up on the cancel culture, you know, and when they do, first they canceled Bill Cosby before the mainstream picked up on him, and you see what happened to him. They're using it as a tool to pretty much destroy someone's character to the point where they're easy target. That's what I see. They canceled R. Kelly before they went and got him. You know, he was cancel culture. They took him off of not playing his music on Spotify anymore and everything else, and then next thing you know, they could bring up charges on him and, you know, no one cares. You know, it's very dangerous. And this is all being done by the social media people. In fact, they can use their bots because they got millions of accounts that's not even people. And they can start thumbing down in people's stuff and cancel them out that way. There's so many ways they could do it. That's why it's dangerous.
Okay. Can I be heard?
Henry in Chicago, yes, sir.
My daughter's school, she goes to private school. They're giving the parents options. If you want to keep your child at home, which we probably would do, you know, you could do remote learning. But also, too, you know, there are some people who, you know, want to send their children, and they're going to guarantee, you know, social distancing and everything. So there's options at the school. But the topic that Thomas brought up in regards to the technology summit, I had an interesting conversation with a non-white black male who I've been friends with since high school. He used to be an executive at a power search company, and he was talking about how he used to deal with Amazon. And apparently Amazon has their own code book of words that they use, and he has this book, and he's going to let me borrow it, next time I see him. So I thought that was real interesting when he said that, because he was like, "Yeah, Amazon is a totally different company that he used to deal with when he was a sales executive at this company, and he had to learn this code book that Amazon has in regards to their communication." I think the book he said was called the Everything Store or something like that. So, yeah, Amazon has their own word and code guy. So I thought that was interesting. I'll mute my line.
Words are important. Jeff Bezos, billionaire, Washington Post, words are important. When you get a copy, that would be another one to have if we get a copy or PDF to look over that. What's in their code book? What words do they say use and don't use? And if they have, you know, like is it a glossary? And yeah, I would be, yeah, would love to see it. Love, love, love it. Words, super important. Let's see. 30 seconds. Anybody have a final comment they can get off in 30 seconds?
During the case, Amazon calls their third-party vendors.
You should have got a different person.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Have a nice evening.
Much obliged, Thomas, in New York. Do we have a different person, or
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to make a quick comment on the cancel culture term. It sounds like to me that racists resonate with racist behavior. So I think they came up with that term for protection. So, you know, don't punish just white person for blackface. They did a 1998. You know, just be gentle with them. Don't be about cancel culture. That's what I think. And that's all I have to say.
Interesting. I almost played a report. They were talking about cancel culture, but it was related to, like, Thomas Jefferson and people like the statues and stuff from Confederate soldiers that they want to take down. And they were saying that that was cancel culture. And it was the same thing, like, oh, man, do we have to get rid of Robert E. Lee? Like, really? We got to put him in the closet? Man, cancel culture. That was the type of tone that it was taking. Anyway, all done. Can you finish? Can you do it in 10 seconds, Thomas in New York?
I was simply going to say Amazon calls their third-party vendors in their code in-house competitors. And Congress asked, why do you do that? And they didn't, you know, they did a bucket of words.
They are codified. Jeff Bezos, that's not an accident. Words are important. We say that all the time. On the compensatory call-in, Mr. Fuller, the word guy, words are important. Major tool. You say violence is secondary. The number one tool, deception. Tricky with the words. So, this year week, the cows retreat. We shall see if the Rona allows all to proceed. We'll have to see how it goes. We can get there safe and sound. We'll report and see how that adjusts the schedule. Man, I'm trying against all will. It would seem like impossible for there to be a book club this week, but White Dog is amazing. I'm going to have to take a week off, even though that's a good thing to take a week off for. But, man, like, White Dog is amazing. Like, you're not reading White Dog, you can get caught up. Yes, sir.
Did you post that? You said you posted a link to it on Facebook, the download?
Yeah, it's already. I posted it a while ago. People already had it. I'll double check to see if it's there, and I'll just include it in the description for the book moving forward. But yeah, I posted it some time ago.
Appreciate it.
I'll post it again. Again, I missed page 104, but I have page 104, and it's inserted now, so I do have the entire book. No voids, nothing missed. Romaine Gary, White Dog in its totality. Spectacular read. Looking forward to getting into more. And we're not even halfway into the book yet. Like, man. Compensatory call in. Thanks, everyone, for participating. Hope it was worthy of your Saturday evening this August 1st. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. We need our brain computer. I mean, it has been a lethal, depressing, stressful year. We need our brain computer working at maximum efficiency. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled. I'm of the opinion we should be trying to hunker down as much as possible, and then we got to go out for, you know, work-related things or whatever, essentials. But, man, to the degree that you can, hunker down. Should have included that one. They were talking about street wars, shootouts with the protesters and officers in the streets, like, in addition to the Rona. Just heard that 13-year-old passed away, 9-year-old passed away. Herman Cain. Take it seriously. Hunker down if you can. If you got to go out, you are super alert. You got your mask, distancing. You are paying attention. If it looks like somebody is turning up, they're mad about the mask policy or whatever it is, fighting over a parking place, anything like that, assume that that person is probably armed. Get out of there. Not taking any risks. It has been way too dangerous of a year. 2020, system of white supremacy. Black lives are not valued. Can't even keep the street sign painted. If you're going out, like I said, we are sober passenger or driver, we are buckled. If you are behind the wheel, you are not on the cell phone. First of all, we need all of our attention, paying attention. Are there race soldiers? Any other dangerous whites we got to be mindful of? Second, minimize contact with race soldiers. Doing the little things that we can. Try to minimize problems as we get from point A to point B. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
Shut I'm up. A victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.